space, the final frontier. These are the voyages of the Starship Enterprise. Its continuing mission:
to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations, to boldly go where no man has gone before.
Crap!
Operator, give me the number for 911.
6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0, blast off!
God's name is going on in here. What was that ruckus?
What ruckus?
I was just in my office and I heard a ruckus.
Could you describe the ruckus, sir?
Watch your tongue, young man. Watch it.
Modern terminology, for short, you'd call it LOL, you know, like laugh out loud, or LMAO, I think it is. Yep, that's what it is. Anyway, in modern terminology, in the mainstream science, I would be classified as what would be known as a heretic. Yeah, I speak blasphemies against science. I mock and ridicule NASA. And I do all the crazy stuff because I'm outside the box and I refuse to get back inside the box. They say, get back in this box, boy. And I'm like, no. Not only no, L-O-L-M-A-O or whatever that is, that crazy stuff the kids run around typing to each other all day long. Nonetheless, mad science is around for a reason, because I feel like mainstream science has pretty much dropped the ball, and mainstream science has pretty much let humanity down to the extent that you still hear stories about people in this world that can't even get a fresh glass of water. And that's frustrating, because the technology that we have today, we got magic machines called, what are those things called? Dehumidifiers. And if you understand how a dehumidifier works, then you'd understand that you can quite literally pull water right straight out of the air. Because we know that science has said that water and air is pretty much one and the same, because there's hydrogen, oxygen, nitrogen, and a few other gases out there in this atmosphere that we are kind of floating around in. We go sea of energy. And while you're floating around in a sea of energy, they're always telling you there ain't no such thing as free energy. Well, we're going to look into that today. We're going to find out whether there is or isn't any such thing as free energy, and probably get a little radical and become blasphemous against the mainstream religious scientific community, and even scientism. That's just as bad. I'll probably get them scientism guys coming in here trying to try to exorcise a demon. They'll be like, get behind me, you heathenous, blasphemy, mad science, unconventional dude. Yeah, so that's old crazy hair shazizz for you, because unconventional energy. Yeah, what is unconventional energy? Well, according to when you Google it up, it says unconventional energy, what is considered unconventional energy sources are wind, tidal, solar, nuclear, geothermal. Occasionally these sources are also referred to as renewable energy. They are used all over the world. These sources are not standard because they are still relatively new compared to oil and gas. I want you to contemplate on that for a second there. Just about everything listed there was in the classification of free energy. You didn't have to pay for the wind to blow, but it did. Anyway, you're listening to Mad Science at www.shazizradio.com. If you want to join in on the chat, jump over there to the superchat.html. And the reason why I call it Super Chat is because there's four separate chat rooms. One of them from Awake Radio, it's preserved in the honor of the founder, Granada Steve, my friend from way back in the day. He's no longer with us. It's sad, but I kept the ball rolling because I wanted to keep his dream alive as well. But anyway, you also have the Shaziz Mad Science chat and the Shaziz Mad Science backup chat, and you have the TCT chat room. And as well as if you scroll down underneath all those chat rooms, you can click on that real nifty banner ad for People Radio and go over there and join in on their chat room as well. I kind of think their chat rooms are probably a little classier than mine. They got some neat tools, I guess. But anyway, hey, it's just as long as we can get together, as long as we can, throw some smoke signals over each other and be able to talk, with this modern technology, that's the deal. Also, check out Wolf Spirit Radio while you're at it. There's other affiliated networks out there, too many to list out right about now, but if you stumble around this website, you'll run into all kinds of links. And speaking of links, jump up there to the very top, right above in the super chat room, right above the radio player. And there is a Stevens resource page. Stephen Gibbons is a wonderful contributor here that has spent a lot of time gathering up links to alternative energy and researchers and put them there all in one nifty little bucket for everyone to come and take a look around and see what they can come up with. So, thank you very much for that, Stephen. It's a pretty awesome page. So I think there's somebody trying to get a hold of me there. Let me see if I can get a hold of them. I think I know who it is. Alright, let's see if I can add somebody up in here. Let's see, send a message. Yeah, let's try this. No, we don't want to do that. Skype call. Jive turkey. Sorry about that, folks. It's like duct tape and bailing wire around here. I'm having a hard time figuring this out. No buttons. Oh, let's see. Skype call. That's the one I need. There. Alright, so anyway, basically, why do they always gotta have all them loud noises going on? Okay, when you're done, let me know there, Mr. Skype. Alright, he ain't picking up, and that's driving me insane. I'll wait for him to call in. Ah! Alright, so anyway, like old Shaziz is the heretic of the science community because, you know, my terminology doesn't always match. And that's why I guess I catch a lot of grief because people want to tell me how stupid I am. I don't know what I'm talking about because I'm not using the lingual, so to speak, the terminology that they're accustomed to, what the school book says. You know, I spent a lot of time researching the school book. I spent a lot of time paying attention in science class. And years ago, they started off telling everybody that we needed clean, renewable, alternative energy sources so that we could save the planet from global warming and a hole in the ozone layer. Now, there you go. Let's see what happens here. All right, how you doing there, Mr. Raymond? You got your microphone muted again? Jive turkey. Alright, well, Raymond figures out how to get his microphone unmuted. I'll finish out what I was saying. So, anyway, they said they needed clean, renewable, alternative energy because, you know, we was destroying our planet. We're polluting everything up. And granted, you know, in a sense, we do kind of mess our fishbowl up a bit here and there and make it uncomfortable, but nature's pretty powerful. Nature has options. He's working on it. Nature is not only the best recycler in existence, nature is the best teacher in existence. Nature is a powerful energy source of epic proportions. See, just in that unconventional energy, which is quite crazy because they say unconventional, you know, that means it's not the norm. That's not normal. We use AC or DC current, you know, and got all this mathematics to prove it. So anyway, the unconventional energy is what we don't use as a standard, I guess, and why we don't use it as a standard, some would say because of financial, and some would say because of conspiratorial, because the oil industries don't want, to not be able to sell oil and, so on and so forth. They want to sell you electricity. It's that simple. So I spent, quite a few years after that, you know, researching all kinds of stuff. But it all basically started when I got in a fight with a power company. You know, I shut my power off and was really rude to me about trying to get the power back on and all that kind of jazz. And, didn't they seem to have any kind of safety net or any kind of sympathy for, what did he say? Oh, he's talking to Raymond, I think.
Am I there yet?
Yeah, you're there.
All right,
Raymond finally made it.
Speaker on my speaker's on my phone, on my computer, evidently quit working, so I had to put my headset on.
All right, well.
Hey, man, this is very, very interesting subject you are in here today about unconventional. I mean, you know, I thought about wind and water being conventional. Tag on. So I automatically started thinking about other things like, for example, carbon dioxide when you're fermenting something. That is very, very unconventional energy because, I mean, think about this a minute. Wine bottles, if they don't kill the yeast and they put the wine in the bottle, it will actually explode and blow that bottle to pieces. And the thing is, I have personally put 200 PSI in a wine bottle and it held it.
Yeah.
Now, 200 PSI, think about this a minute. 1 PSI will raise water 2 feet. So 200 PSI will raise water 400 feet. And a gallon of water is roughly 8 pounds. So 8 times 4 is 3,200, foot pounds of energy. Think about that.
Yeah.
Just these people making the homebrew beer in their garage or out in their storage shed. Homebrew, as long as you don't distill it, is legal. You can make as much as you want. Well, the byproduct is carbon dioxide.
Well, that's a...
Under pressure. And the pressure will raise that water, and that water coming down can make electricity, or it can do other things. It powers energy. That's unconventional. It's energy that's there that nobody is using. You don't lose the carbon dioxide. After all, I mean, think about this a minute. You're making carbon dioxide, which is a sellable product. You're making it under pressure, so you don't have to burn energy compressing it into bottles. And the byproduct, one of the other byproducts, is the dead yeast from the alcohol content building up, which that in itself can be dried and used as animal food. And you're making alcohol at the same time, which can be fuel. I mean, and you're not using, burning any electrical or other types of energy. You're just letting these plants grow, produce carbon dioxide, produce oxygen, alcohol, and animal food all at the same time.
Yep.
I mean, is that or is that not unconventional energy?
Well, that's the thing. You know, see, I basically started off talking about unconventional energy, and actually the definition for unconventional I posted in the chat room as well. Basically, where the heck did I do with that doggone thing? There it is right there. Not based on or conforming to what generally done or believed. And that's the whole key about what I want to talk about here today. Because, basically, when you hear me on the Mad Science Show, I don't always have the proper terminology to make people happy in what I'm saying. What I do have is this gift. This mechanical mind ability to kind of look at things in a different fashion than otherwise. You know, it's like people go out there and they repurpose all kinds of things. What would have been just a cardboard box might end up being a shelf to somebody else. You know, they might figure out a different use, or, you know, taking the materials from that cardboard box and cutting it into making something else. You know, some other deal, repurposing something that would have otherwise got thrown away. And that same thing can even apply in energy, electricity and such. See, one of the problems that we've got with a lot of the different things that we run is heat. Heat is not always our best friend when we're trying to get energy to use for certain purposes. However, it's kind of crazy that we will generate electricity to try to produce heat. That's amazing. Right? But in the process of generating heat with using electricity, what do? We end up generating more heat, and then we got to keep certain things cool, otherwise they get hot and they burn up. They meet their thermal breakdown point and they fail. So
that's a beautiful analogy, man. Beautiful.
So what I'm saying here is maybe we going about this the wrong direction. Maybe this doggone thing that we call heat, maybe that is where, you know, we should be focusing our energy, because we've already proven by trial and error that we can generate a lot of heat. I mean, the internal combustion engine will generate enough heat to quite literally destroy itself. Just as well as if you're trying to pull too much current off of something, you know, you basically get the windings hot and even the cores get hot because we're cramming so much energy into a transformer that transformer can't handle it, and so it meets what we call resistance and, you know, develops like eddy currents and stuff. Well, those eddy currents, they're like whipping around in there, they're like a little whirlpools, and they're producing friction, which in turn is producing heat, and the longer you run this, the more you try to ask and demand of this doggone transformer, the hotter it gets, and eventually it'll start smoking, burn off the insulation on the windings, and then destroy itself. So, with that said, with a guy like myself that just refuses to get back in the box, and I started looking at energy in a different fashion, I spent many, many years studying everything there is to know about alternative energy so that I could basically keep my promise to the power company. I told the power company when they did me the way that they did me and they basically treated my family poorly, I said, I'm going to dedicate the rest of my entire life to studying every single thing that there is to know about alternative energy. And when I get that accomplished, I'm going to share it with each and every one of your customers for free. So when your wallet gets thin, you're going to have me to blame for it. And so that's what my ultimate goal was. Well, I think it's about time right now that I'm going to start doing some things that I'm basically going to take every single bit of what I have learned over these years and what I've tried to share with the world, and I'm going to put all the criticism aside. I'm not even going to have a debate or discussion with individuals that disagree with what it is I'm trying to say, because most generally they can't get their mind out of the school book long enough to look outside the box to see that there are other options, other repurposing things that can be done, different ways to move energy, different ways to use energy. So I'm going to take an unconventional approach to the science community and be that well-known heretic in the whole religion of science.
I like the way you think. It's cool, man.
So anyway, my plan is to do this. I've witnessed a lot of things while researching. I've actually burned up a few things, and in the process of burning up a few things, I kind of realized what was actually causing the failures in there. When you're running your average generator, in the conventional sense, not the unconventional manner, which I'm going to start to share with the world on how to unconventionally get the same amount of power, possibly even more, and steadier, cleaner energy without going through the old conventional method of destroying your generator in the process. Capacitor technology is going to play a huge part in that, because if you understand how capacitors actually work, what a capacitor actually is, without getting into the whole high-tech terminology and some really in-depth explanation scientific-wise of what a capacitor is, you got a plate. You got two plates. You got one positive and you got one negative. Normally, because of nature and how nature functions, each one of these plates have so many electrons. They want to be balanced out. They want to stay balanced out. And so in between these two plates, we got a little bit of gap there, Just the atmosphere alone in itself is a dielectric. A dielectric is basically an insulator so that these two plates aren't touching each other. And it would take a lot of voltage to jump through this dielectric to short out these two plates. Well, because these things want to be balanced out and the negative wants to get to the positive and such, well, you've got to have a little bit of gap in between there. So when you put a charge to these two capacitors, they start to exchange electrons. You get more on one side, all the negatives on one side and all the positives on the other side. And even that dielectric in the center can actually add to the capacitance of the capacitor, because the dielectric, even though it doesn't has insulation factors and it's non-conductive material, still has atoms in there that want to align themselves. And so if you've got the positive pushing one way and you got the negative pushing the other way, it helps to force electrons out on the opposite side of whichever polarity you're at. So they'll call that polarized or non-polarized in that capacitor. So that's something, if you're really interested in, you'll have to look up if you're interested in the high-tech terminology. But I'm trying to put it down to the basic simple. So we put more electrons, positive charge on one side than the other side, and now you have equivalents of power stored in there, because now nature wants to balance it back out. And if it doesn't have a path from one side to the other, it will hold that charge just like a battery. The difference between batteries and capacitors are the batteries aren't really happy about being charged and discharged rapidly. They don't like that, because of the way that batteries actually function. In a battery, you have two plates as well. Actually, you're going to have more plates, but just for simple battery, you got two plates. You got a positive and a negative. But the difference between this thing and the capacitor is that now you have an electrolyte in the center of these two plates. Now, an electrolyte is a conductive material that does allow some electron flow through there. So the chemical reaction can occur inside there and you'll build up a charge. However, now it's essentially like a dead short. When you're trying to charge a battery, it takes a little bit more to charge a battery than it would to charge a capacitor. There's where the trick comes in. See, a lot of people don't understand that you can't charge a capacitor the same exact way that you charge a battery. So if you go out there and you look up some YouTube videos, you'll notice that if you try to hook a capacitor bank, like a boost cap multi-capacitor to a regular standard battery charger, if you try to hook it directly to there, you'll note that it's the battery detects a dead short, and it will then in turn shut the switch off inside the, if it's a thermally protected, otherwise it'll probably just set itself on fire because essentially you have a dead short with that capacitor because of the how close that those plates are actually to each other. They basically don't want to allow a lot of current flow into those batteries. Now see, what a lot of people didn't understand as far as that, they figured out ways around that. I mean, you can hook a light bulb in series to that same capacitor and to that same charger and then be able to run that load, that power through that load and light the light bulb up while charging that capacitor. So that's how they were able to figure out that they could actually charge with a conventional charging system instead of an unconventional like we're going to talk about. With a conventional charging system, they had to put something in between there, a resistor or something, to basically slow down that current flow so that they could actually get that thing to charge. Well, that's a good way to get it charging. So then now they can charge their capacitors. But what they didn't realize was voltage is pressure. And inside those doggone capacitors essentially is the equivalent of what you would win if you had a balloon. If you was going to blow up a balloon, you put pressure to that balloon and the balloon would expand. And if you hold that into that balloon, it'll hold that power in there until you let go of that power. As soon as you let go with your fingers, it's the equivalent of you putting a path to from one side to the other of that capacitor. Now all of a sudden, as those energy stored in there can balance themselves back out, and the capacitor would be empty again, according to the way it's all explained. Does that sound like a simple explanation of something that would have otherwise been high tech terminology there, Raymond?
Makes sense to me.
Yeah, so basically when you're trying to charge a capacitor with current, it's actually harder because you're trying to force your way through what would be the equivalent of a dead short. Now I put a video out called 9 volts. I also put one out called Unsubscribe. And in that video, I explained about how this little hand generator, when you very first start trying to put the power to that capacitor bank, you meet a little bit of resistance. But once you break through that initial deal and you get all the physics going inside that capacitor, it becomes really super simple to turn that crank to keep putting energy to that capacitor. And keep in mind, in that video, that particular system had absolutely no batteries involved to run all the circuitry that was in that system. It was all nothing but capacitors. And then if you notice in that system, I was also showing you that I would crank for a little while, charge it up, and then I'd stop and wait for a bit, and then I'd crank a little bit more, and then I'd stop and wait for a little bit. And what I was hoping to explain and show to people is so you could actually watch via this circuitry the energy, how it is actually flowing from the large tank all the way down to the smaller tank, and you can watch it almost quite literally going down to the very smallest load. And so that if the large capacitor had any energy in it whatsoever, all the smaller ones below it would be completely full, and you would be able to run your loads direct off of this particular deal. See, when you're pulling off of a main a conventional generator, in the conventional way that we use electricity, you're actually causing a lot of problems to occur. Are you spray painting over there?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, don't be huffing no paint. Get all crazy on me.
All right, go ahead.
Anyway, that's what the thing is. Science goes on even while the radio show's happening. There's somebody working. Anyway, so when you're trying to pull energy off of your average generator in the conventional sense, you're actually allowing that energy to make a loop right back into the same generator you're trying to pull that energy off. So when I come in and I say things like, that generator that you got is capable of doing a whole lot more than you can possibly imagine. There's a whole lot more power available in any generator. It doesn't matter what the wattage is. It doesn't matter what the amperage output or the wattage output or anything like that. It's how you're going to pull that energy off there is going to make the difference of how you're going to be using that energy. And so if you got this generator head and you, let's say it's a 5,000 watt generator. Now you got this thing running. Every time you turn a light bulb on, you'll hear that engine bog down a little bit. That's because it's now meeting resistance, that lens effect that occurs every single time you add some more path to the other side. You're allowing electrons to flow back in there, producing a second magnetic field that is now acting as a brake on the armature that is slowing it down. So they're trying to counteract each other. They're trying to stop each other from going in the opposite direction. Nature's trying to balance everything back out. And so once you got an understanding in your mind mechanically of what just occurred there, now you got to ask your question, I want this energy off of this generator, but how do I get this energy off this generator without making this generator either work harder than it has to or quite literally fall on its face and begin to fail? So the more you put on there, if you put too much of a load on your standard generator, first off, you'll probably blow a fuse, because if it's fused, then it will draw too much amperage, which will cause basically that resistance to burn the fuse in half and shutting down the power on there. And then suddenly you'll hear that generator kick right back up again, but you won't have electricity out the other end. And so replace your fuse, repeat the thing a couple more times, you'll blow some more fuses, and you'll continue to keep on doing that until you finally realize, well, if I draw too much off this, I will short it out. But that means a lot of that energy that generator is actually generating is going to waste. So, according to science, it says energy can neither be created nor destroyed. That's, I think, under conservation of energy, ain't it there, Raymond? Laws of thermodynamics? So, you know, that basically, you gotta conserve. Well, that's because we're using this energy all wrong. We're using it improperly. There's a guy out there named Gerard Moore, and he's also kind of outside the box, but he's actually got one foot inside the box as well. So, yeah, but at least he's better off than most folks. But he figured out that he could actually take a 2,500-watt generator and run that output of that generator into a 50 kV transformer, and then drop that energy from that 50 kV transformer down into a smaller container, smaller capacitor, because that's exactly what a transformer is, that like the ones you see on your power pole. It's a capacitor slash step-down transformer. So anyway, he took the energy coming off of that 2,500-watt generator, dumped it into a large transformer, and then down into a smaller transformer, and was able to run more than that generator should have been able to run according to the wattage specifications on there. Why was it he was able to do that? Because he wasn't putting that load directly on that generator that was invoking that lens effect that creates that second magnetic field. Instead, what he was doing was using the capacitor portion of the transformer as a buffer. And then he was using the smaller container as his storage for the real-time on-demand energy load. And because of the frequency range that he was sending this energy into the transformer, it also gave him the energy on the output that was regulated because of the capacitance of the transformer and the step-down capabilities of the transformer itself. So he was able to run a real-time load off of this deal. So what could we learn from that? we could learn that what Gerard Morin just did was step outside of the conventional way of using energy and get a better efficiency out of an existing off-the-shelf generator system. And so a lot of these folks out there that are trying to do, you're trying to get more for less input and all that kind of stuff. On one sense, they are on the right track, but on the other sense, is if they're stuck inside the conventional version of what the book says can or cannot be done, then they are hindering themselves because they're trying to fight against something. Those laws of physics that people are convinced are written in stone are now like a fence, you know. It's a wall, brick wall, in between you and success in your alternative energy device. And once you understand that you can't necessarily go through this wall, but you do realize that maybe, since I can't go through that wall, I could probably climb under that wall. Or if I took a shovel, I could dig a hole under the wall, and I could go under the wall to the other side, or I could go around the wall to the other side. That's where unconventional energy comes into play. Because if you understand what's going on with physics, if you understand what's going on with how energy actually travels, now you have the tools necessary to figure out when to use these laws of physics to your advantage, such as the lens effect. You know, you've got to get past that cogging effect if you ever want to be able to get a generator to be super efficient and run itself. And so how do you go about that? Well, you got to use unconventional methods in order to figure all that out. But nonetheless, with that same doggone thing that happens with the lens effect, they have what's called regenerative braking, where now you're using that force to actually stop a vehicle, and then in the process, when you push your foot on the brake pedal and it creates that second magnetic field that slows down your motor and brings you to a stop, the moment you release your foot, all that energy stored in that coil system will now feed back into your power system and put energy back to your electrical system there. So somebody stepped outside the box and used some unconventional thinking and figured out a way to use what we call the back EMF, which is basically that second field collapsing in the coil and coming backwards and then sending that energy where they wanted it to go, such as in the battery bank. So anyway, you know, when you're talking about capacitor technology and you're talking about battery technology, the two can actually help each other. You can get a sudden boost because of the speed at which a capacitor will discharge. They got what's called battery bat caps, where it's half battery and it's half capacitor, because whenever something's really cold and you need a lot of boost to let this energy go through there rapidly into your starter, capacitor's the one for the job. And in the stereo system world, to supplement your battery, you add capacitor bank to your battery so that your capacitors are actually the buffer between your battery and the load. And when the amplifier demands more of that battery, the capacitors will take up that slack. What you doing there, Raymond?
Trying to cover my mic so I don't make any unpleasant noise. Sorry right. about that.
No, that's all right. We know you're spray painting over there and shuffling.
Yeah, I'm trying to get something done and listen to the show at the same time. Sorry about that.
Well, Skype has this thing called a mute button that you could use, though. But don't forget it's on.
But I don't have a mute button on my headset, though.
Oh, okay. Well, anyway, so basically, folks, what I want to try to share with everybody is, from everything that I've researched in alternative energy, there are unconventional, different ways, methods by which we can actually use the same energy that we're using, but use it in a different fashion. For example, Raymond, do you remember when you was out here and you and I took that X13? And we actually spun that thing up and was able to energize the argon gas into plasma and basically when that little thermal switch was is, which is that fluorescent bulb starter, when we first fired it up, you could see that there was purple plasma in there, and that plasma got hot inside there, and then it would heat the thermal switch and make the connection so that now you're using the standard conventional way of using electricity, and the light bulb come on as the generator was dropping on its face. Do you remember that?
I remember it like it was yesterday.
Yeah. So what did you learn from that?
Don't touch it.
Oh, yeah, that too. So you can get electrocuted. But, yeah, there's a lot of energy in there. But the thing about it was, we were taking energy off of that generator without the resistance of the conventional sense, and we turned that energy into plasma. You see that?
Yep.
And up until we tried to run it on the conventional sense, when we had about, it was either 100 or 150 watt light bulb that we ran off of that deal, and it lit it up. It lit it up really bright, but it also allowed the electrons to flow back in there and stomp on the brakes, so to speak.
I remember me picking it up and setting it down real fast, and you said, did it burn? I said, I don't know. It just won't take me long to look at it.
Yeah.
That was hot.
That's the thing. You know,
yeah, really.
Not only were we generating plasma, you know, with this, the generator wasn't having to work hard to get to the plasma state. Plus,
Lord, yeah, now you brought up a strong point there. It was not working hard at all.
But the moment we switched from unconventional to conventional, you've seen a drastic difference, right?
Oh, unbelievable pull on that thing. It was unreal, the power it took to turn it.
Yeah, it dropped right on its face. But we were able to, prior to that switch turning on like it was designed to do, because it's a little thermal switch. That's what those fluorescent bulb starters do. They will allow current to flow through the element that heats up, warms up the fluorescent lighting system. And then when that heat is inside there, then it will shut that portion off and then allow nothing but the high voltage to go through there to energize that vapor inside there into, you know, basically ultraviolet light that then in turn energizes the phosphorescence and gives you a visible light spectrum. So now you got light.
Yep.
So that's basically simple of it. But either way, that's what makes those a little bit more efficient than running a regular incandescent light bulb. Even though fluorescent lighting is actually a little more efficient than running incandescent, it still has its inefficiency because every so often, to warm that bulb up, that fluorescent bulb starter will, you know, basically trip the switch and send more current through there in order to turn those little heating elements on the end on. Now, see, if you wanted to design it properly, you would take the tungsten element completely out of it and run it on just the frequency alone. That's doable, and it's provable, because we're able to take what would otherwise be dead light bulbs that won't work in the conventional light outlet. We were able to energize these anyway using high voltage, high frequency, which you also did an experiment at your house.
You just said the word provable.
Yep.
The thing is, it's not... It is provable, and the thing is, people don't understand, you proved it on video. And I turned right around, came home, and did the same thing multiple times. I lit 15 bulbs, 15 fluorescent bulbs on less than 40 watts of power.
There you
40
go.
40 watts for 15 bulbs. How many watts per bulb is that? How many times will 15 go into 40?
I don't know. My mathematics is basically unconventional.
Let's put it this way. 15 times 3 is 45, and I was doing it with 40. So it was actually doing less than 3 watts per bulb.
Yep.
And the bulbs say on them that they burn 40 watts.
There you go.
But if you measure it with a watt meter, it comes out 38 watts. They actually take 38 watts to burn, and you and I were lighting the things with less than 3 watts.
Yep.
And the only reason we were doing it is because they're lighting them with 660 volts. You and I were using 20,000 volts.
Yep. But we were
it's
also using, as far
that
as...
That creates the light, and the fluorescent light because the fluorescent light, like you said earlier, it is, it's not a visible light. It's ultraviolet light that you cannot see. But when ultraviolet light strikes a fluorescent object, such as fluorescent powder, that's in the bulb, it causes a visible light.
Yep.
So in reality, you could the more voltage, which there again we've said the same thing on this show many times, voltage is easy to make.
That's
because
it.
There's nothing but pressure.
And the thing about it is, when it comes to using current or just voltage alone, you can charge capacitors with just voltage alone. And I need you to really contemplate on this, folks, because what I'm telling you is really important. When you're trying to put a lot of current to a capacitor, you will meet resistance because you're trying to cram too much energy in there too fast. But the way that high voltage runs is different than the way high current runs, because it doesn't meet the resistance like current meets the resistance. It's like trying to cram, you know, 50 gallons of water down a small pipe as opposed to 50 gallons of water down a large pipe. Does that make any sense
right.
to you? So
it makes a lot of sense to me, because I've done it.
Yeah, you'll get backup, you'll get resistance, and that's why resistors get hot. Resistors are designed to basically resist the current flow so that you can actually get some of this energy into the capacitor. But in the process of that, you have now created a loss, because that resistor is generating heat from the resistance of that current trying to get through that resistor. You see what I'm saying? So
right.
by using high voltages, not high current, just high voltages, number one, like Raymond just said, it is really super simple to produce high voltage. You can rub your feet on the carpet and produce high voltage. You can pick voltage up out of the air, atmospheric energy, and the deal about that is maybe that voltage in itself won't run your standard generator because your generator wasn't designed, or your electric motor, because your electric motor wasn't designed to run on that type of energy. So, you know, it would take some re-engineering to make it be able to do that. But the problem that you're having is that you're not pushing enough current in there to make this motor turn. So how
right.
do you get that high voltage back to a state of matter where you can now use that energy to run this deal? Well, by being able to know that you can pressurize the capacitor like blowing up a balloon, and you can do this rapidly because of the way that capacitors actually charge. All this the capacitor's looking for is a difference, a potential difference. You know, more negatives on one side and more positives on that side means that capacitor is charged. And so if you've got high voltage, you can send it in there rapidly without meeting the resistance that you would otherwise with trying to cram a lot of current in there. So you can charge these capacitors rapidly, you can discharge these capacitors rapidly, and once that capacitor is pressurized or charged up, the way the conventional saying would go, it's now charged up. That capacitor is now dangerous, quite literally, because there's a lot of stored power in there. That's why they use capacitors to give a punch to electric motors to get these things to do that initial turn, so that once it does, now this motor can actually spin up to speed, and once it gets up to speed, its physics and centrifugal force and all that takes over, and it takes less energy to keep it running now. You don't have to have that capacitor running constantly. However, the capacitor is assisting by acting as a buffer between the energy input to the energy output to the actual coils of the electric motor, and is making it to where it has an extra amount of electricity stored, an extra amount of energy stored in order to maintain that motor if that motor becomes under a load. Does that make sense to you in a simple term?
Yep.
So what we can learn from that is that if we decide we want to pull our energy off of our generator, we understand that if we try to pull that energy directly off of our generator, we got some effects that are going to occur. We're going to invoke Lenz's law, and the more load we put on there, the more the second magnetic field is going to get stronger, and to the point where there is a limitation of how many watts we can actually draw from that. And when you're trying to draw too much power, There's heat generated in two separate directions. One towards the load itself, because it's trying to use more amperage, and one towards the generator itself, because it's trying to get more amperage out. It's being pulled more, which is producing a lot more resistance that causes this thing to get hot. So if you're trying to draw too much from the generator, it's getting hot. If you're trying to cram too much into the load, it's getting hot. Those are both negatives, because both of them will cause either your output source to fail, or it will cause the actual windings in the generator to reach their thermal breakdown and fail. So now that we got all that figured out, now we need to figure out a way we can pull that energy off there without invoking that lens effect and creating all these extra eddy currents and things that we do when we're trying to draw amperage from this generator. So we're going to pull this energy off in a different fashion, such as when you take a bridge rectifier, you can change that into AC current, or from that AC current to DC current. So now you can actually charge a DC capacitor with it. However, if you've only got one load as opposed to multiple direct loads, then you are going to produce some sort of draw from that generator, but not near the amount that you would have otherwise trying to draw direct from the generator. Does that make sense to you, Raymond?
Yeah.
So,
can you hear me?
Yeah, you kind of went low.
Oh, okay.
So, maybe scoot closer to your mic or something.
Yeah.
And so, anyway, it'd be the difference between trying to run one incandescent light bulb or 10 incandescent light bulbs. If you can get the same amount of energy off of that generator by only having to run one bridge rectifier and putting that energy directly into a storage facility, or even taking that energy directly instead of having a bridge rectifier and changing that energy into the plasma state, where now you're pressurizing that chamber with plasma, you still have as much energy as came out of that generator, but now there's no way for those electrons to make a path back to the generator. So you're getting the energy out, but you're changing the energy into a completely different form of energy. Alright, so before I start talking about all that, once again, we're talking about unconventional energy. Alright, now the conventional sense would be you're pulling it direct off in the form of AC current and you can only run so much. But if you have a 2500 watt generator and you transfer that energy into the plasma state and you don't have any means by which the lens effect could actually occur that would send any of that energy back into that generator, up until, now this is really key right here, up until the point where you overpressurize that chamber, and now the pressure in the reactor becomes higher than the pressure inside the generator that you're trying to push out, which would equalize those two forces, and the reactor would actually start pushing back on that generator. That's when the problem would go back to the conventional sense of where you're now putting that generator under somewhat of a load. However, if you're taking that energy away from that generator in a consistent fashion, you're using that energy up in the form of heat or light or radiant energy or DC rectified current out the other side of the system there. As long as the energy is going away, then that means that that initial prime mover, which is your driver force, your generator, is not having to work under a load. Pay attention to what I just said there, because that's really important. That means that now that generator, if it's a gasoline generator, will, number one, use less fuel. It will have to work less harder. Is that a term? A term? A phrase? Less harder?
Yeah, I don't know. But it sounds good to me.
All right. Well, it won't have to work near as hard. That's phrased a little bit better. Yeah. So that means that generator will not generate near the amount of heat that it would have otherwise had to generate, trying to fight against all these forces to push that energy out that you want to use. That means your generator is going to stay cooler. That means the likelihood of you reaching the thermal breakdown point decreasing the viscosity of your oil to make your oil real thin, and now your bearings will start to wear, and the motor's getting really hot, and you got to get rid of that heat or it'll tear itself out. So now the generator can pretty much sit there at idle speed, push that energy out, change the energy that you want into a completely different form of energy, which is now plasma, the fourth state of matter. Now you have light, you have heat, you have radiant energy, and you have direct current coming out of the opposite side. Up until the point whenever you start using that power, this will continue to pressurize. And so at the point where the pressure gets higher in the chamber than it is coming out of the generator, those two forces will try to equal themselves out, and in the process, thus putting the generator under load. But we're never going to allow it to get to that state, because we're going to run our energy in an unconventional fashion, such as we're going to take some of that energy out of that chamber via heating water with, you know, so now we can actually heat water and move that energy away from it. So what can we do with that heat from that point? There's all kinds of different things that we can actually do for that heat. We can either circulate that heat through a radiator style system and transfer that heat into the atmosphere of your home and heat your home, or we can take that heat and we can change it using the Seebeck effect, which now we're into thermoelectrics, where there's a temperature difference outside of the system that you're transferring the heat out of. And there's a temperature difference on the side where you actually have the atmosphere in your house. So as long as you have a temperature difference in two dissimilar metals, then you can get what's known as the Seebeck effect and produce thermal electricities. Works in thermal couples, thermal piles, Peltier elements, and other devices out there that are classified under the thermoelectric. So that was one on the list of unconventional energies that we got were able to get out of this generator that we started running. Now keep in mind, we haven't even focused back on the generator yet, because even standing there idling, this generator has vibration, it has friction because of the way that it was engineered, and it's not to its full potential as far as efficiency. It has losses in the system. That generator in itself is producing heat that then in turn could be used to supplement even the outcome of the generating the heat generated by the plasma that we just produced inside the chamber. So now we got a two for one thing. We're taking all the heat that is generated from this system, and keep in mind, through this whole entire process, that generator does not have to work any harder than it would have otherwise. It doesn't have to work near as hard run conventionally, and it now is more efficient, because now you're able to take some of that waste heat energy away from that engine and bringing that engine temperature down to where it doesn't have to work near as hard. And as long as the internals of that engine don't reach their thermal breakdown point, then they will not fail. So now you have a generator that will last multitudes times longer than it would have otherwise running it in the conventional fashion. So now we got all this energy moving away from the generator. And keep in mind, while we're on that generator subject, that generator is also vibrating, right? There's piezoelectrics that could be introduced into the system, where you actually set the generator itself on a piezoelectric pad, and the vibration of this generator is constantly flexing these crystals, which is producing piezoelectricity. There's also an audible sound that this generator is making. That sound is putting out an acoustic wave that could also be tapped in as another energy source. As this internal combustion engine is running on this particular generator, it is also producing an output exhaust, which is also producing heat as well, and pressure as well.
I don't want to change your subject, but you just said something I did years ago. I took a speaker on a commercial job. They get these speakers in the ceilings that they play music and stuff. I took a speaker out one time and hooked my multimeter to it. And I live right in the landing path of DFW Airport.
Yeah.
And years ago, the planes would fly over top of my house. I mean, less than a half mile high, making a lot of noise. I aimed that speaker at one of the jets coming in for a landing, and it was actually producing electricity. So you're right. I just wanted to say so the people would understand this noise you're talking about.
Yep.
It will produce electricity.
That's right.
Okay, go ahead.
It produces acoustic wave that then in turn presses on the diaphragm, vibrates the diaphragm, which in turn turns the coil up and down, pushes the coil up and down across that magnet, which produces a change in polarity that in turn produces an AC current out the side. With a little mini bridge rectifier and a capacitor, you can actually charge that capacitor up just using the acoustic waves coming out of any audible sound, that especially bass, because bass is like directional. It's
I just wanted to bring that up so that it would enforce what you just said. It's not possible. It's doable.
Yeah.
You've done it.
It's provable.
I mean,
unconventional,
it's
but provable.
It's absolutely doable. We've done it.
Yep.
You know, this is not theory. This is exact.
And using that same method, you can actually transmit data from one speaker to the next. Because if one speaker is the receiver,
yes,
and the other speaker is the driver, when you pulse that one speaker, you can get dots and dashes out the other side. And basically, a wireless acoustic transmission of energy and data from one speaker to the next.
You know that on the Great Wall of China,
yeah,
that they actually did that? They would take a drum, fasten it to a piece of stone in the wall, and they would beat on the drum, and another drum that a half a mile away would pick up that sound and reproduce the sound.
Yeah.
So what you're talking about was used 1,000 years ago for signaling on the Great Wall of China.
Yep.
It's doable. It's done. That way.
Well, you remember back in the old days when we were kids, we used to take a pork and bean can and we'd drill a hole in the bottom of the can and tie a string through each one of them and stretch that string out nice and tight, and we could actually talk to each other like we were on a telephone.
Yeah, we took beeswax and rubbed the strings to coat the outside of it. It did not lose its vibration in the air as bad, and you could actually stretch the string even farther.
Yeah.
And then we took, when you had the old-fashioned can opener, you put it on and you turn it, and it cut the top out. We put the hole in the bottom of the can, fastened to that top, and let the top go in there, and it would create more vibration so you get more volume.
Yep.
I mean, we did all kinds of weird things when we were kids like that. We could do that and actually talk to each other 100 miles away. I mean, 100 yards. At 100 yards.
Yep. And another thing is we learned about those old road cones. They make good amplifiers.
Oh, heck yeah. They were fantastic. Like a bullhorn.
Pick up those road cones and scream in your brother's ear. You'll make him deaf.
Uh-huh. Oh, man. So you're bringing back some good old times, man.
So anyway, what I'm trying to do and what I'm going to be doing for probably the next year, I can't really go into detail about exactly, and everybody who's involved until everybody's got everything sorted out and permissions to say certain things, but I'm going to be showing everyone some things that I have learned throughout my entire studies of alternative energy, and what I've been explaining to you here now is a little sample of what it is that I'm talking about by using energy, unconventional energy. I'm using it in an unconventional, not based on conforming to what is generally done or believed. So for those folks out there that want to argue mathematics and physics and all that kind of stuff, I'm not even going to humor those individuals outside of telling them what it is that I'm telling them. And if my terminology doesn't meet and they get angry and call me everything under the sun, well, so be it, because I already know I'm on a mission and I'm going to prove by the time it's all said and done, what it is I'm saying. So now I have the opportunity, because of some events that has occurred here recently, the Dream Team is alive and we are ready to go. So we are actually going to together work on multiple projects that are going to benefit the world in an amazing way. And using unconventional knowledge that has been acquired from trial and error and research and all the things that I've learned from every bit of all these different alternative energies out there. You know, there is so much to be learned in this world. If you, you know, there's things in this world. Raymond, do you know what sulfur hexafluoride is?
I have an idea. Go ahead.
Well, sulfur hexafluoride, according to the definition, sulfur hexafluoride is an inorganic, colorless, odorless, non-flammable, extremely potent greenhouse gas is what they call it. I don't like greenhouse gas, but anyway, this is their definition. And an excellent electrical insulator. This is a gas that is an excellent electrical insulator, otherwise known as a dielectric, that could be used in a capacitor. So it won't allow electricity to jump across it. So you could quite literally build a super high voltage capacitor that, using the gas instead of your normal plastic or whatever type of dielectric, that it take a lot to break this stuff down. And so that's why, if you look really hard on sulfur hexafluoride, you might find it in the electrical industry for certain uses. But nonetheless, it's also a good firefighting gas as well. So if you had some sort of problem and your device somehow or another blew up the sulfur hexafluoride, because it's a much heavier molecule than air, it will suffocate the air out. You see what I'm saying? And put the fire.
Yeah. Okay.
So anyway, it has an octahedral geometry consisting of six fluorine atoms attached to the central sulfur atom. It is a hypervalent molecule. Anyway, essentially, most people would just overlook something like that. You know, that's a really interesting deal right there, because, you know, if you ever want to be able to push oxygen away from something, sulfur hexafluoride is what you want to use to do it, because it's non-toxic. People actually, I don't know why the heck they do this, but they breathe this stuff in and it'll make their voice talk really deep. You know, they call it the deep voice gas.
That's where I heard it. I saw a deal on YouTube, where two guys were in a classroom, were showing some high school kids. They put it in, like, they had a fish tank, so you could see it. And they real slow filled the fish tank with this gas, which you could not see. And they took a piece of tinfoil, and folded it up to make it like a boat or a barge.
Yep.
And it was literally floating on this gas.
Yep.
And then they took their finger on one corner of it, just barely pushed it down, so the gas started to flow into it, and this thing sunk like a big ship. I mean, real slow.
And they were also able to take a cup and dip it into it, like just like dipping into water, and take that cup and then transfer it over and put a fire out on a candle.
Right.
So that's how heavy this gas is. Well, the same thing to some extent could be applied with carbon monoxide and carbon dioxide, because those are also heavier than oxygen. But to the extent of what sulfur hexafluoride does, no, that's probably the most impressive, you know, to put fires out. You know,
yeah.
You're always supposed to spray at the base of the fire whenever you're putting the fire out, because that's where the fuel is. And
the oxygen comes in from the bottom and
yeah.
goes up into the heat. I wonder why that wouldn't be work really great in putting out oil well fires.
It probably would. Probably be amazing.
Make a big circle, a pipe with outlets in it around the fire, and then just start pumping this gas in, and the fire would suck that gas in and put the fire out.
Yep.
And at the same time, being under pressure, it would come out cold and cool the hot metals. And that's one of the things about putting out an oil fire They use dynamite or nitroglycerin, whatever, and they explode it. It blows the oxygen away from the fire. Well, the fire goes out, but the heat from the metal that's heated up is so hot it reignites the fire.
Yep.
Or if you use a compressed noble gas like your sulfur hexafluoride, it would be very cold, and it would not only put out the fire, but cool the metal as soon as the fire was out, before it could reignite. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah. So,
all right.
Basically,
how expensive is that stuff anyway?
I don't know. I never really looked into a price of it. But I'm going to go ahead.
The thing is, you got to stop and think, what's the expense of the gas, and what's the expense of putting out an oil well fire, and how much money are you losing in the fire?
Well, apparently,
I'm not putting it out.
Apparently, I mean, it's not too
expensive. Everything boils down to economics.
Apparently, it's not too expensive because people are actually making a lot of YouTube videos and breathing this stuff in. And, you know, because helium will make your voice all squeaky, where sulfur hexafluoride will make it all really deep and everything. But the problem is, like,
right.
You got to get this stuff out of your lungs because it's heavy and you have to, you know, breathe and get it out of your lungs. I wouldn't even put it in mine, you know, intentionally. Even though it's non-toxic
right.
and non-flammable, I still wouldn't do it. You know.
Better have some monkey bars so you hang upside down.
Yeah. But anyway, that's
Just do it leg hanging. And just hang upside down and breathe in and out real slow but deep.
Yep. That's just one little example of, if you understand what this stuff is actually, what it actually is, that you can, and you understand the mechanics, the physics of it, then you can find all kinds of uses, like what you said about putting out an oil well. That would, an oil well fire, that would be perfect. Because
yes,
it's
it would.
Really heavy. It would push that oxygen away and keep it away. And allow time for that metal around there to cool down so that it doesn't reignite once you shut it off. So,
yep.
You know, there's folks, there are solutions to every single issue out there. But right now, our main issue is to try to give to the world something that I believe, and guys like Tesla and Bedini and Stan Myers and all these different alternative researchers out there believe that if you could actually give to the world free energy, which is pretty much already been given to the world, yet it's not conventional. So that most people don't understand it because they're not taught about it in school, and they don't understand that it doesn't take near as much energy to do what it is that we're doing. And if we actually learn different methods by which to extract the energy that we want to get work done, then we're able to, you know, be more efficient. We're able to work, with cleaner environment. Your efficiency means that you're not going to be using near the resources that you would have otherwise to try to run the same doggone generator. If that generator doesn't have to work hard to run the load on the other side, is what I showed in that video on subscribe and what I've been trying to explain to the world for a long time. Is that generator will barely have to work. You seen in that video where when I first started turning it, I had a little bit of resistance because it, you know, I'm trying to push a lot of power to this thing to get it started. But once I opened that gate, that got easier and easier to turn. And once I got a charge going through the system and the energy moving away from that generator, then it was able to just every so often I go crank it a little bit, let stop, wait for a while, let the energy run downhill, crank it again, stop, wait for a while, do the same thing, and I didn't even have to work hard in order to keep that thing charged up. And so if I needed more juice, all I had to do is spin it a little bit faster for a little bit longer, and I put more to it. But as long as that main bank of capacitors had power in it, any power whatsoever, just even a tiny bit, then that means every smaller capacitor under that was fully charged and able to run a load in real time. So now that we figured out that we actually have the power to pull that electricity off of that generator without sending energy back into that generator, just by simply changing that energy to a completely different form. And even if we want to just take and go with a bridge rectifier on the standard generator because it's producing AC current, and then we're going to change that energy to a DC current and be able to charge a bank system, our load is going to be drawn off the bank. It's not going to be drawn off the initial prime mover, which is the generator. Does that make sense to you, Raymond?
A lot of sense to me.
So you're moving the power away, and now the only load that you have to worry about is whatever that bridge rectifier is going to put back on it. And that's it. It's equivalent to running one light bulb on a 2,500-watt generator. You're still able to get the power out that you need to charge this bank up. And depending on the size of your bank, you've got a large bank of energy stored. You're already ahead of the game for the energy need that you need on the other side to run that load. You're not having to worry about it. All you got to do is continuously keep just a little bit of energy going through there, which means that that main generator is not going to have to work near as hard as it would have otherwise running all these loads direct.
Right.
So if you want to just go straight from the generator to a bridge rectifier to a storage bank, that's going to be, you know, more efficient than it would be. But if you want to take and get that thing to incredible efficiency, you're going to not use the bridge rectifier to begin with. You're going to change it into a completely different frequency or a completely different form of energy, which in my case, the research that I've been talking about is changing it from the normal electric current that's coming out of that generator into the plasma state. So now that you have heat, you have light, you have radiant energy, and the pressure built up in that chamber will also act as a bridge rectifier and give you DC current out the opposite side. All of this technology that I'm talking about is existing technology. It's based on already existing technology, such as the mercury arc rectifier that was dated back to the earliest of late 1800s, early 1900s. It was used to change Tesla's high voltage AC current into high voltage DC current so that you could run the already in place infrastructure, the elevator motors that Edison had in place for his electrical infrastructure.
I thought it was Edison that did the mercury arc rectifier.
I don't know. I have to look back into it, who actually invented it.
They were using the mercury arc rectifier to change the AC to DC Edison's time, and it was Tesla that found out you could actually use the AC, because AC current is a whole lot easier to make than DC.
Yeah, because of the way that it's actually traveling. It's basically pulsing. So you're not trying to cram it all in through one shot. You're sending it through a higher frequency, like we're doing it at 50 or 60 hertz. But even at that, it's not that AC current wasn't, it was definitely better, it was definitely safer, but if used improperly, you can generate just as much heat, that you would be from trying to run a DC load. You see what I mean?
Well, the thing is, a lot of people talk about DC generators. Do you have any idea, the people out there, the listeners, does anybody have any idea just how difficult it would be to actually make a generator that generated DC current?
Yeah, that's
or DC electricity.
That's part of.
I mean, that would be. It's almost impossible.
That's part of.
It's extremely difficult to make a generator that generates DC.
Yeah, that's
electricity.
That's the doggone. See, that's part of the doggone mainstream, the conventional misnomers about things. If you got a magneto or something like that, that's going to be closer to a DC generator.
That's just about as close as you can get.
Yeah, but in reality, the way that thing's actually going past the magnetic field and fluctuating back, you're actually getting more closer to a pulse DC than you would, but it's more like AC, flat out.
And flat out, it's more like AC than anything else.
Yeah, so it's just about how you're actually changing that energy from one to the next. One is a little bit, one's a little safer to use than the other, as far as I'm concerned. Because one ain't drawing a whole lot or trying to push a whole lot of amperage all in one time. It is allowing for a lot of current flow, but it's not trying to push all this energy forward in one time, which basically, if you know anything about DC power, you know, if you're running like a light bulb system and that there's a lot of amperage that's going through there, that amperage causes that wire to get really hot, and you can actually start a wire fire by running too much amperage through that wire. So we got methods by which we cut back that power before we send it into certain things so that, you know, only the resistor's getting hot. Even at,
right.
Even at that extent, that should be a red flag to tell you that if it's getting hot, you're doing it wrong. You see what I mean?
Right.
Unless you're using unconventional energy where you're intentionally taking what would have been otherwise classified as unusable or junk energy to produce heat.
Right.
Which is what I did in that that doggone dead light bulb that we actually lit up using a 20,000 volt oil burner igniter.
Right.
We were able to, because we understood how that energy was traveling at a higher frequency, was able to literally leap across the doggone broken tungsten element inside that halogen bulb and light that bulb back up anyway, because when you energize that gas inside there, whether it be via the frequency or the actual heat from the element itself, that energy released is what's producing the visible light inside there that you use to when you're driving down the road so you can see where you're going.
Right.
But we lit up not only a burnt tungsten element light bulb, but burnt up fluorescent light bulbs and
yep.
energized gas into the fourth state of matter, which is plasma.
Right.
So that's all because understanding of how energy's traveling and thinking at it in a more of a mechanical sense than a conventional sense, in an unconventional manner, we are going to start using unconventional energy. What do you think?
I love it.
So anyway, I'm going to be working on some projects. And as I'm able to, I'm going to share these particular projects with everybody so that you can see that there is definitely a provable method by which we can use energy in a completely different fashion, an unconventional fashion, not like the conventional sense, you know? What the whole free energy debunkers like to call, you know, they try to say pseudoscience. No, it's real science, folks. It's basically paying attention, testing, and being able to, like Raymond mentioned earlier, he saw something I did, he took it to his place, he repeated it. That's the scientific method. It was testable, it was repeatable, and so on.
Yep.
So, it's proven science as far as I'm concerned, because you can do it too at your house. So, when I begin to share these videos and information with people, and my hopes is that they will actually test it too. You'll try
you know,
it at your house.
I did something, I don't know if I told you about it or not, but in playing around with your deal about hooking up that old burner igniter, 20,000 volts, we hooked up the ends of the wire from the igniter to the ends of the bulb.
Yep.
I actually took a bulb and did not hook the wire to it, to the ends of the bulb. I took the wire, a real small wire, like 22 gauge wire, enamel coated, and wound it in a spiral around the bulb about every 3 or 4 inches, a spiral.
Yeah.
Okay? You're touching the glass, not the ends of the bulb.
Yep.
And run that 20,000 volt through it, and it still lit the bulb.
That's right, because at the frequency range, it's sitting there pulsing back and forth, and it's shaking those molecules inside that gas and producing everything necessary to produce the light.
Yes, it was. And, hey, here's the amazing thing. I put two bulbs, one on each side of the bulb that are spiraled the wire around, and all three bulbs lit up.
Also, you can take two pieces of aluminum tape and put them around those fluorescent bulbs, and you can pull DC rectified current off the other end.
Yes. It's totally amazing, man. Totally.
Because it's actually coming via radiant energy. So, basically, what I'm trying to explain to people here, and I'm trying not to be repetitive about this, but unconventional energy is basically where you need to start focusing if you're going to try to do alternative energies. The terminology used that I guess kills a lot of the alternative energy researchers is, number one, perpetual motion, because that's the one that the laws of thermodynamics comes really hardcore out against. Zero point, all or over unity, getting out more than you're putting in, or getting energy with zero input, that kind of deal right there. Those terminologies are not anywhere in the realm or the neighborhood of free energy. If you can't find free energy, you're simply not looking hard enough. But if you try to go to those three different terminologies right there, that's where you get all this craziness, where these debunkers and these so-called physicists and so-called educated individuals will come out there and have an advantage over you, because they'll be able to try to misquote the laws of thermodynamics to tell you why it is it's not possible, because there's too many losses in the system and such. So don't give them that option. You know, energy is free. The unconventional energy that we mentioned here earlier, let's see right here, sources are wind, tidal, wind obvious, windmill, tidal, when the waves are coming in and out, it's pushing a paddle, which is pushing a magnet back and forth across some coils and charging up. Solar, which is using multiple different light spectrums, and not to mention heat to get you all kinds of different thermal electrics or thermal water heaters, or solar panels themselves. And then you have nuclear power, which you're taking something like your refined uranium and putting it into highly radioactive rods, and using that depleting uranium to actually boil water to produce steam that in turn turns turbines and so on to produce electricity. You have geothermal, where there's certain depths under the ground where the temperature is hotter, and there's certain depths under the ground where the temperature is cooler. So you can actually put two separate deals. I need to add Ted to the call here. You can actually put two separate deals together that, there it is right there, Ted, add him, that will actually have a temperature difference, where now you have the Seebeck effect able to occur. So at one depth it's really hot, and at another depth it's really cold. So you've got two different probes that are going down into the earth, and one is producing heat and the other is producing cold, and those two temperature differences will produce thermoelectrics. So,
you said something a minute ago.
Yeah, go ahead.
You said something a minute ago about light, and the thing is, there are certain light wave energies of the spectrum, of the light spectrum, that will actually ionize the air and make the air itself, in that beam, such as the laser,
yeah,
if you get the right frequency, it will act just like a copper wire. Now, you say a copper wire is used like a railroad.
Yeah.
It's a road that the electricity travels down. You can take certain light frequencies, and if you put it in a laser, shine it as a beam, the electricity will actually follow that beam easier than it will go through the air.
Yeah.
So you don't even really need, in other words, wireless transmission of electricity. If you have the right frequency and a laser, you can actually shine it on a spot and cause electricity to go from your generator to another spot without wires.
That's right. You can actually use
light. You follow what I'm saying?
Yeah. You can actually use light to transmit data. You can use light to transmit electricity. And it basically, it's all about the receiver,
All right. Now, wait a minute. Let's carry this just a little bit farther. Electricity. All right, you've got a battery charged up. Is there any electricity in that battery? No. There's a plus or minus electrons.
Well,
it's potential.
Yeah,
now,
that's
the
it.
Thing is, we're talking about clouds here. Clouds build up a potential of energy. If you took a laser, the right frequency, it shined it at a cloud. and hooked it to a wire to the ground or a battery, it would actually suck that energy out, or it would give a path for that energy to leave and come and charge your battery rather than building up and causing a lightning bolt to go from one cloud to another. You see what I'm saying?
Well, yeah, the lightning rods aren't there to actually capture lightning, whereas if a lightning bolt actually did hit the lightning rod, it's actually got a wire that goes down to ground so that it shoots straight to the path to ground instead of blasting all over your house. But nonetheless, because of the high voltage, it's still going to knock out your appliances and stuff as well. But
the whole point of a lightning rod is to deionize the cloud before it has a lightning bolt. So therefore, it is actually transferring electrons. You could actually put something in between the ground rod and the lightning rod itself and capture that electricity and put it in a capacitor or a battery even.
Yeah.
That's possible. Why aren't people doing that?
That's why, Tesla's radiant energy patent, that's pretty important. I've actually started working on an antenna for an atmospheric receiver so that, you know, there's an equation out there for every 3 feet or, you know, every yard or every meter off of the ground, there's a voltage. It goes up 100 per meter or 100 per yard as higher you go. And so the reason why we're not getting electrocuted because of this voltage is because we are acting the same way as that lightning rod. We're displacing those electrons before they ever get a chance to build up. You see what I'm saying? So we're the equivalent of that lightning rod.
You said something earlier about this, the technology is already there.
Yeah,
we have the technology to build a machine that can measure, can literally stand on the ground and measure how much charge there is in a cloud. Then we have the technology to build a laser that could shoot that into that cloud, creating a path for those electrons to travel to that lightning rod before it became a lightning bolt.
Yeah.
You see what I'm saying? So, and collect and energize the cloud before it even built to anywhere close to the point of creating a lightning bolt and actually draw the electricity from the cloud. I've said it 100 times on this show. People, they're trying to catch lightning. No, that's wrong. You pull the electricity out of the cloud before it charges up and releases the lightning bolt.
Yeah, and so basically, what you just explained there was what I was explaining earlier about the plasma reactor, that, you know, it is building up pressure. Stephen said the oldest patent I can find for the mercury arc rectifier is issued to Ulray Dayton, working for Westinghouse in 1923. So that's pretty impressive, man. I'll tell you what, Stephen's amazing.
Yes, he is. I like that boy.
But he's got a link here, folks, of the mercury arc rectifier. You can actually take a look at it. It's pretty impressive. But basically what they had back in them days, Raymond, and we've been joined by Ted. How you doing, Ted? He got his microphone off. But basically what they had back in the day was a plasma reactor. How you doing there, Ted?
Good. How you doing today?
Oh, another fascinating day with all my friends talking mad science. We're into unconventional energy now.
I love it. Every day.
Everyone out there who is normally used to paying an electric bill, that is because you are using conventional electricity. So if you want to understand what mad science is all about, then unconventional energy is where you need to be. Now, I can step outside the box, put the school books down. You already know what the school book said. Now, take all that knowledge that you have acquired, use those laws of physics to your advantage, and let's talk about what we can actually accomplish. So, I honestly believe that there are some incredible things that you could actually do if you understand how to move energy from one place to the next. It's not that
The thing is, you've said it several times, and even today several times, about the technology is there. But the thing is, there's so much technology say this person knows this person knows that person over here knows this, something else. But nobody's putting it all together. That's where your dream team comes in.
That's it. And my dream team has already been put into play. It's already on its way. So, folks, I guarantee before it's all said and done, you're going to see some really cool things on how to use energy in an unconventional manner that you're going to still be able to enjoy the luxuries that you're able to do right now, but you're going to be doing it in a more efficient, more environmentally friendly manner, and you're going to be doing it at so much less of a cost than what you're doing right now. That's my promise. Before it's all said and done, that's my gift to the world, is I'm going to take all this knowledge that I've acquired in my research and I'm going to put science to the ultimate test. Because if science is what science was supposed to be, you know, the observation, then, you know, unconventional is what made it the Wright brothers could fly an airplane. Because they used to say the conventional way of thinking was that if man was meant to fly, God would have gave him wings. Well,
and he did. We call it a Boeing 747. Daggone it.
Yeah. But the unconventional way of thinking is the way way of living inside the box, or the conventional way of thinking is the way of living inside the box. And if you're willing to stay inside the box, conventional thinking will have you arguing with the unconventional way of thinking, because those folks standing outside the box, they can see the big picture. They can see the way that things work mechanically, and they can take those laws of physics and use them to their advantage. You know, we already know we can't compress a liquid. That's easy. We got that figured out. But we do know that because we can't compress a liquid, we can use that liquid as leverage to build hydraulic systems that can lift tons of weight, whereas the human body can't lift very much. I can take my little tiny arm and I can move this lever, force some liquid in with a positive displacement pump, pressurizing that chamber and pushing a heavy rod, lifting a 2-ton car off of the sidewalk, because now I got the power. You see what I mean?
There you go. Yep.
So I just took unconventional and turned it in to, you know, the power to do something, to get some work done. This is what I've been saying all along, folks. You know, maybe I'm going to make a lot of people angry on my journey through here, but by the time I get to the other side, there's going to be a better way of doing things. It's going to be more beneficial for humanity. We've already got every piece of the puzzle. Now it's a matter of having to try to prove to the world in an unconventional manner that the conventional way of doing things is the wrong way of doing things. I mean, it works, but why would you burn up your appliances because you're drawing too much amperage when there's a way to run that same appliance without making it have to work so hard, and it'll last nearly indefinitely until nature breaks down the parts inside there, you know, via natural processes. Why are you speeding it up by putting too much heat to this part and not enough over here or whatever? By understanding the laws of physics and understanding science as it was supposed to be from the get-go, that's why I'm a heretic, folks. That's why mad science exists, because the high priest of science out there that say, oh, you can't do that, that violates the laws of thermodynamics. And I'm like, well, why don't you take them laws of thermodynamics and use them a bit differently, and now they become your friend instead of the brick wall you keep running your face into. That's what I'm saying. So maybe I'm a radical heretic, basically mocking and ridiculing NASA and the science community because they are basically selling their souls to the devil, so to speak, basically sticking it to humanity. This information has been around for so long, and the folks that try to bring it to the table, I think somebody else is trying to get in here, but we're going to have to see who it is. Let me see if I can add Thomas and Jermaine.
All right.
So anyway, talk for a minute while I do some adding. Add? You're supposed to talk, man. This is live radio. Alright, so anyway, we're talking about unconventional. How in the heck? I think I already added Jermaine. Alright, let's try that. See who shows up. You guys still there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Alright, who all we got in here now?
Me, Raymond.
Ted's here.
Okay, Ted's here, Raymond's here. Jermaine, are you in there yet? I think I added 3 of 5 in the call. I think I've added 5 people. Anyway, they'll figure it out, pick it up if they want. Otherwise, we'll have to go on without them because the show must go on. Looks like Jermaine's in here now.
Yeah.
Hello.
Hey, how's it going?
Hey,
we are talking about unconventional energy.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. There's actually a list of them out there, according to Google. You know, Google's like it's like that old man with the white beard on the top of the hill. You know, you go up there and say, "Hey, old wise one, speak to me, old toothless one." Yeah.
You know, basically, you said you Googled unconventional energy, and they included wind power, water power, sun power, and to me, those are not unconventional. They're conventional. We do it all the time.
Yeah.
When you say unconventional, I'm talking about things like you lighting up those light bulbs. I'm talking about carbon dioxide gas. I'm talking about the charge in electrical charge in clouds. I mean, that to me, that's unconventional. Nobody's doing it.
Yeah, but see, they're saying
power, and it's there.
They're saying wind, tidal, solar, nuclear, geothermal. It says occasionally these sources are referred to as renewable energies. They are used all over the world. These sources are not standard because they are still relatively new compared to oil and gas, which is a hockahooey, man. They were using wind power way before they ever used gas because, you know, when you wash your clothes. And you hang them out there on the line, it's not the electric element inside your doggone dryer that's drying your clothes. It's the wind and the atmosphere and the evaporation that's drying your clothes. So they were using wind power way before they were ever using electricity. So that's just one little tiny example.
Think about all the sailing. Think about the way that people cross the oceans in sailing ships.
Yeah.
I mean, that's been going on for 3,000-4,000 years.
So they were using wind power to get from point A to point B.
The wind is not unconventional. I mean, my God, come on, man. I mean, they use sun to dry their grains and stuff like that. So solar energy is not unconventional. It's not conventional. It is conventional. It's not unconventional. I mean, come on, man. That's totally wrong. The definition is absolutely untrue. It's one person's idea.
Yep. Did we lose Jermaine already?
Ideas are like buttholes. Everybody's got one, you know?
Huh. Yeah, did we lose Jermaine already? You still there, Jermaine?
He's still there. No, Thomas is there. Jermaine dropped out somehow.
Oh, well, maybe he'll be back. So anyway, basically what I'm trying to say here is for this next project that I'm working on, which I'm not going to talk about a lot of it because, there's somebody involved in helping with this project, and I'm going to make sure that they're everything's taken care of for them first, and I'm going to share all this information, what I can, as I'm going, to give you a general sense of what you can actually do to make your generators so much more efficient than they are right now. By taking everything that we've learned from the laws of thermodynamics and physics, that what these things are that are causing that would normally be classified as waste, how we're going to start to re-guide that energy to where we want it to go. You understand
right.
What I'm saying? Not where, it's just going to go haphazardly wherever it wants to go and back out into nature. We're going to focus all this energy where we want it to go using the laws of physics to our advantage. And so your average generator that's producing enough heat to literally destroy itself, Now we're going to be using that same generator to do a purpose. You know, we're going to be transferring heat. And if you study heating and cooling, HVAC, and you understand how that functions, and if you understand compressor technology and how that functions, you understand the physics of what happens when you compress a gas or allow this gas to expand rapidly, then you understand what it is that we're saying as we're going along. It's so ridiculously simple. When you get down to the simple science of it, you don't need all the high-tech terminologies to understand this in a mechanical sense to where the average Joe gets it. You see what I mean? You don't have to be a rocket right. Science is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah.
But we're going to repurpose things. We're going to recycle everything, including what would otherwise be classified as wasted energy. We're going to focus and guide all energy used where we want it to go. We don't want it to go back in the generator because that costs us to have to use more fuel. It costs our prime mover to have to work harder. So what's that phrase? We're going to work smarter than harder?
Yeah.
Work smarter, not harder?
Right. There you go.
So you guys got any thoughts?
Work smarter, not harder.
You guys got any thoughts on this? Ted, you got anything you want to add into this conversation here?
Well, yeah. I mean, I love unconventional energy, and, you know, I just have to say I agree with y'all. Like, it's really not unconventional to use techniques that have been around forever to generate electricity. They've been using these techniques for torque, movement, you know, whatever, machinery for a long time, but I guess it's unconventional because now these things are going to produce sine wave 60 hertz current.
Yep.
Right.
That's it. And that sine wave 60 hertz current makes them a lot of money. You can meter that. You can't meter a plasma reactor. Nope. Can't do it. So they're not going to like that one. Just like they didn't like Stan Meyer running around in a dune buggy in the 70s with hydrogen technology. They didn't like that one. But we don't care what they like. What we care is what is the best for humanity. And when it comes to the mainstream scientists, they can come over to this side of the fence and, you know, basically they can yell across the fence and call me a heretic. That's all right. Because I'm going to give the world what the world said they wanted, and I'm going to do it using their science. I'm going to do it using their technology and all the research that has been put on the table, all the pieces of the puzzle being put in the right place to show people what you're actually capable of doing. That's the whole thing. They're going to say, oh, well, you can't do that. And I'm going to say, well, stand back and watch as I do it.
People are always saying, people, you can't do that. That's a common thing.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, if you step outside the box, you're going to see that there's a whole lot more possible than what you've been told. And the reason why they keep telling you stuff is basically to keep you paying and keep you filling up their wallet. See, they use the capacitor technology that I'm trying to talk to you about using by pumping money into their wallet so rapidly that they could go out and spend this in an uncontrollable fashion and never run out of money, because you're putting that money in their wallet so fast that they have more than enough money to go out and live high on the hog. Well, if you do the same thing with capacitors, if you understand how energy travels and you're putting it into those capacitor banks so rapidly that they can never run out, then you have energy on demand that you can use just like you would have otherwise, except you're not doing it in the conventional sense and making your generator have to work harder than it should have to begin with. Your generators that you've got out there are capable of doing so much more than what they are doing right now. They're capable of lasting so much longer than they are doing right now. Everything has a thermal breakdown. If you understand that basic concept that once everything gets to its thermal breakdown point, it will fail. That's when you got to replace it. Even transistors have a thermal breakdown. If you can keep a transistor cool, it will do its job and it will never, ever fail. Think about that. How many transistors have we blown up because we tried to put too much current through them? A lot. And maybe you take those transistors, you get them to do their job, and use that energy coming out of there to produce a high-frequency wave that you're then in turn going to move that energy forward into a storage bank, and then you don't draw directly off those transistors, you draw off the storage bank, and so the storage bank is acting as the buffer between you and your driving force, so you don't get those things hot. They don't need to get hot. And I've proven that in some of the smaller anomaly videos that I've done, trying to show people that I can run this little particular gizmo and I can put my finger on the back of that transistor or MOSFET, whichever the case may be. They're both fast-acting switches. One handles more current than the other. But either way, after running those for a while in the conventional way, you put your finger on the back of that, you're going to have a blister on the finger size of Texas. Because you just generated a lot of heat and transferred that heat energy to your finger. And now you're sitting there going, ow, ow. But doing it the way I'm talking about, you can stick that doggone transistor on the tip of your tongue and then stay there all day. It's not going to do nothing but probably taste terrible. That's it. That's some of that dielectric grease. Now, don't go out taste testing dielectric grease, because who knows what's in all that. Anyway, you know, that's it. Unconventional energy is the way of the future. If you want to help to support mad science, go out there and make you a t-shirt. I'm going to see if I can find the link again. I think it's on the Mad Science Podcast page. But I'm going to throw a link in there to my t-shirt design that I got. And, you know, I'm not trying to sell any t-shirts to anybody. All I'm saying is if you like what the concept of this is, go out and make you a t-shirt. Get you a Sharpie and an old t-shirt of your favorite color and draw this saying on there. All right, and basically be a walking billboard for mad science. You know, don't vandalize people's sides of people's buildings. They'll come over here and try to blame me for it. Anyway.
Actually, if you get right down to it, I think you ought to do that. There are people out there that would like to have a t-shirt, but they don't want to go to the trouble of having one made. So why don't you just make some up and offer them? That's a good idea. I'd buy one.
Well,
yeah, I'd probably buy two or three. One for me and one for my wife. Well, actually four, because I got two sons.
Well, somebody who...
I think you ought to do it.
Somebody who has a good business mind, maybe want to step in there and do that and sell them for me, and then we'll use that, whatever the profit is to work on Jermaine's projects, your projects, Thomas's projects, anything mad science related. So if anybody wants to do that, that would be spectacular.
I want to do it.
Alright, so basically what the shirt says on there, it's real plain and simple. It said, "Mad science is the key to the truth about free energy. Ask me why." And it got www.shazizradio.com.
Alright, I'm going
to
do it.
So that gets... I'll send you a link to a picture of it there, Raymond.
All
right, but that gives basically an open dialogue. That opens up dialogue, all right, and gets people here talking about things. I think,
you know, think about it. Let's talk about this t-shirt just a little bit, about one or two more minutes, okay? Do you realize what it costs to go to a t-shirt shop and have a t-shirt made?
No. Nope.
Or if you go there and tell them you want 100 or 200, it's going to cost you dollars and dollars and dollars per shirt less. So now I'm going to do this. I'm going to do it because that's going to help the listeners that would like to have a t-shirt but don't want to spend $50 or $60 for a t-shirt to have it made.
Well, there you go, man.
I can get the t-shirts made and sell them for less than $20 a piece. Duh.
All right, well...
Help everybody get it. Are you going to do it? Well, I'm doing it. Thank you. You gave me permission, correct?
Yep.
I'm doing it.
If Raymond wants to do this and y'all want to buy a t-shirt from him to help support the researchers like Jermaine and Thomas and myself and Raymond and Ted and any mad science guy, I'm good with that. As long as you get a t-shirt that...
I'm giving my pledge right now that if we make a profit, every penny of profit will go toward mad science and anybody that's working on a project in the lines of what we're talking about. That money will be used to support mad science and mad science inventors or scientists that are working on projects. Every penny. Not one penny of profit will go in my pocket or Shazza's pocket. That's a promise and an oath.
Well, that sounds wonderful.
I'm going to go up Monday or Tuesday. I'm going up to Harry Hines in Dallas. There is a t-shirt manufacturer up there. All I've got to do is take him to the print. And once he sets up, it costs money to set it up. But once it's set up, he can make hundreds of t-shirts for unbelievably low price. We can get these t-shirts out to people that really, really want them. Okay, good deal. We're doing it.
All right, cool. So back to unconventional. Folks, this is the reason why I keep trying to get more people to come here. Not because I want to try to get famous or get attention, because I want more people to hear some other ideas outside of what the book says. Granted, I'm probably going to get attacked by a few trolls. That's all right. I can deal with those turkeys, even the free energy debunkers. I can deal with those turkeys as well, because if they paid attention to their own science that they believe so wholeheartedly into, if they paid attention to their own physics, they would understand what it is that I'm saying is based and provable on real science. It's that simple. If you can't find free energy, you're simply not looking hard enough, because even in their definition of unconventional, they just put out a whole bunch of free energy. Wind, tidal, solar, nuclear, and geothermal are just a few examples of ways, and there are multitudes of different types of methods that you can tap into these types of energy. They didn't even talk about static electricity, ion technology such as the ion group or the atmospheric group that we talked about on the last Mad Science show, where they're pulling energy right out of the air. And as far as in the water distillation portion of it, where we're trying to get people fresh water, folks, we've been sitting on dehumidifiers forever and a day. Dehumidifiers take and clean humidity out of the air. It uses a temperature difference and produces condensation that fills up this little pan in the bottom and produces water. Now, obviously, you wouldn't want to...
Your air conditioning unit is a dehumidifier.
Yeah, your air conditioning. So you're getting a two-for-one. You're getting fresh water and, whatever cleaner air or cooler air, at the same time. So,
yep.
So why couldn't we take these same bits of physics and build a small energy device that not only will put a little bit of electricity into a power source so that they can run lights and fans, and at the same time while they're running this, the physics will actually pull humidity out of the air and give them fresh water to drink on demand. You see what I'm saying?
Yep.
And not only that, I don't know if you've ever put your hand down into the tray of a dehumidifier. That water's cold.
Yep.
Why is that?
It is that.
Yeah. So you get cool, fresh water that could be run through a filtration system in case somehow or another your dehumidifier picked up some dust in the process. You can filter it through something simple as a coffee filter and not have grits in your water. So anyway, we got a way to give people fresh water. We got ways to desalinate water. We got ways to learn what nature has already done through the evaporation process to get water while you're standing next to the ocean. That's one of the things that just drove me insane when I kept listening to how they were talking about how California was suffering this terrible drought. We're all going to die. We can't water our grass. We got to cut up our grass and put in mulch or rocks or pave over the front lawn. I'm like, come on, you're standing next to the ocean.
Years and years ago, all white folks aboard military ship and private ships had a desalinator system in a compartment.
Yeah.
So that if the ship sank and you got it in a lifeboat, there was fresh water there, enough to last a day or two, but then you had a desalination plant. It was nothing more than like an inner tube with a TP on it, and it would suck the water up and condense water, and these things would produce anywhere from 2 to 3 liters of water a day.
Yep. So there you go, man. That's all using basically the basic science and laws of physics to use to your advantage. That's what we've been trying to say all along. It ain't that you don't have enough energy. It ain't that you can't run your house on static electricity. It's that you don't understand that you got to take that, store it, put it into a different state, and then turn around and try to use it. Because once you got that capacitor fully charged, if you had a little trip circuit such as a transistor, which requires so much voltage to come across it, that then in turn will actually turn it on as a switch and allow the current to flow, that capacitor will hold that charge until it gets charged up high enough, and then it'll trip that transistor. Well, that transistor is when it turns that switch on, is a pulse of energy. Now we're getting into frequency. How frequent that thing pulses will determine the actual frequency. If you can get that capacitor to pulse every 60 times per cycle, 60 times per minute or whatever, second, you see what I'm saying? Now you're up to 60 hertz. You're taking static electricity, charging up a capacitor, it's tripping a transistor at 60 hertz, producing a wave that you can then in turn run like pulse DC or pulse AC current. What's it going to take, Raymond? What's it going to take?
Yeah. I mean, like you said it 500 times. The technology is already there. It's just we need the dream team to get together and take all these different technologies and plug them in together. It's called plug and play, folks.
Well, I've finally been able to successfully gather my dream team. And so my dream team, we're up and running. We're ready to go. And so with that said, now we're going to be able to get things done. Part of my dream team's going out to make a t-shirt. That's cool.
Yeah, there you go.
That brings people to the table. It opens up dialogue, because like, what's mad science? Well, let me tell you about it. Jump over here and we'll talk about it. Mad science is the key to free energy. It's the key to the truth about free energy.
Yes.
The so-called fossil fuels out there, folks, I don't know how to say this outside of just flat out saying that there is absolutely no physical way that the fossil fuel industry will ever, 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 ever be able to run out of crude oil. It's not possible. Because every single thing on this planet that is biological, you know, plant, whatever, it is all carbon based. What is in crude oil, all right? What is in the process of making crude oil? You can actually make crude oil in the laboratory setting. You can take they call it biofuel, but essentially the biofuel is crude oil. It's just a little cleaner version of it. All right? So if you can make it in a lab and you can understand that nature is continuously doing the same processes that nature has done since the beginning of time, until those processes stop, nature is constantly recycling everything back into the system. So you're not going to run out of water.
Thomas.
Yeah.
Thomas Anderson has already come up with the solution as far as making your own crude oil in a laboratory. He knows how to take kudzu, which is a trash plant.
Yeah.
I mean, it grows like crazy. He can take kudzu and in a matter of hours turn it into pure crude oil.
Yep. We can do the same thing with duckweed, watermill, grass clippings, leaves.
Yeah.
Hemp?
Hemp. It grows wild in the United States. The government spends millions of dollars every 4 or 5 years burning it off in the state of Oklahoma because it's a wild crop. But 2 acres of hemp will produce more paper than 20 acres of trees per year.
It also produces beneficial oils.
Yes. I mean, paper, clothes, building materials. I mean, it's unbelievable. And yet, hemp, there's so many different varieties of it that some of it is no good for smoking.
Yeah.
But it's classified as a drug. Give me a break. Come on, man.
Yeah.
They classified all this stuff years before they even knew what was going on.
Well, cannabis...
William Hearst, Randolph Hearst, didn't they, push for cutting down all the trees instead of using hemp?
Yeah.
Hearst family, I always heard, my mom always said, blame them for it. Well, blame somebody, son.
Well, that's the whole thing. The industry out there, you know, they want to make money, and if there's anything like hemp that's going to compete with the wood industry, obviously there's going to be lobbyists against hemp.
Can you believe they cut paper? Down all them old trees the last 100 years when they could have been using hemp for most of all that?
Yeah.
Yep.
I mean, look at now, they go to particle board anyway, so why not make something that would actually be stronger than particle board? It'd be fiber board because of the way that hemp is, but you'd be using fibers, which are a lot stronger.
Them are ancestors. Them trees are, older than... They're, that's crazy. Can't believe it, really.
It's all about money. Why would the law passed about growing stop hemp growing in the United States to make hemp rope? It was passed because DuPont invented nylon rope. And if they could get the hemp rope or hemp outlawed, then they could sell more nylon rope to the Navy. And that was just right about the time of the Second World War. Well, and that was the whole reason. Reefer Madness. The movie, Reefer Madness.
Propaganda. Hey, you guys want to...
It was 100% financed by DuPont. The whole entire movie.
You guys want to keep on...
Financed by DuPont.
Hey, hold on a second. You guys want to keep on talking amongst each other while I step out for a second, or do you want to take a music break?
Take a music break.
All right, folks, we're going to take a quick music break so I can go refresh my coffee and take care of business. So let me see here. I got to find something. I'm just going to put this on there.
The preacher man says it's the end of time, and the Mississippi River, she's a gold grind. The interest is up and the stock market's down, and you're only getting mugged if you go downtown. I live back in the woods, you see, a woman and the kids and the dogs and me. I got a shotgun, a rifle, and a four-wheel drive, and a country boy can survive. Country folks can survive. I can plow a field all day long. I can catch catfish from dusk till dawn. Make our own whiskey and our own smoke too. Ain't too many things these old boys can't do. Grow good old tomatoes and homemade wine, and country boy can survive. Country folks can survive. Because you can't starve us out and you can't make us run. Those wooden old boys raised on shotguns. We say grace, we say ma'am. If you ain't into that, we don't give a damn. Came from the West Virginia coal mines and the Rocky Mountains and the western skies. And we can skin a buck, we can run a trot line, and a country boy can survive. Country folks can survive. I had a
good friend in New York City. He never called me by my name, just Hillbilly. My grandpa taught me how to live off the land, and his taught him to be a businessman. He used to send me pictures of the Broadway night, and I'd send him some homemade wine. But he was killed by a man with a switchblade knife. For $43, my friend lost his life. I'd love to spit some beach nut in that dude's eyes and shoot him with my old 45, 'cause a country boy can survive. Country folks can survive. North California and South Alabama and little towns all around this land. We can skin a buck and run a trot line, and a country boy can survive. Country folks can survive.
Space, the final frontier. These are the voyages of the Starship Enterprise. Its continuing mission:
to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations, to boldly go where no man has gone before.
Crap.
Operator, give me the number for 911.
God's name is going on in here. What was that ruckus?
What ruckus?
I was just in my office and I heard a ruckus.
Could you describe the ruckus, sir?
Watch your tongue, young man. Watch it.
Yeah, could you describe this ruckus, sir? We're creating a ruckus. That's what we're doing. We're talking about unconventional energy. And even during the break time, I heard that old Raymond and Ted were having a really good discussion about alternative energy. So, you really want to go back into some of that there, Raymond and Ted?
Yeah.
So.
Raymond was saying that the solar panels weren't really efficient. Oh, go ahead, Raymond.
Right.
Sorry.
Right. Oh, okay. The thing is, the actual cost of building a solar system is, truthfully, it's very good. It'll last much longer and make a lot more electricity. The problem is the people that make it don't sell it for what it costs. They sell it at a profit. And they make the profit margin so high that the system cannot produce as much power as it costs to buy one. I mean, it's ridiculous. Totally ridiculous.
But the problem isn't necessarily the cost of the system per se. It's the fact that people are under the impression that you got to have a massive solar array to get anything done. If you got an electric,
right.
If you got an electric
that
motor that will run,
you don't.
Yeah, you got an electric motor that will run on 140-watt solar panel, and it'll run just like it would be as if it was plugged into a battery, and you add a battery to that thing. While the sun's out, the battery's not only charging, but it's running real-time on demand, and you can take that energy that is now occurring while the sun's running the motor or while the battery's running the motor, and you can move that energy off into a storage bank. So you could actually store that energy using different methods to where now you have a surplus of energy. So even when it's not
right.
sunny outside, you still have energy. And as long as that doggone electric motor is running and you use those forces wisely, you can transfer that energy yet into even more energy. So it's not
right.
it's not necessarily a case you're getting out more than's actually going in. It's a case you're using it more wisely than you were before. So these particular solar panels, they're capable of doing a whole lot more. But in the conventional way that we use these solar panels, it requires more solar panels. You see
right.
what I'm saying?
How are you talking?
So that's the deal. That's why they're so expensive, because people don't get that. Less solar panels. If that solar panel is putting out 100 watts, 100 watts is a lot of power. What could you do with 100 watts? Huh? I think I lost Raymond.
I'm here.
Yeah.
My solar system
I have right here puts out 4 kilowatts.
That's impressive. That's a lot of power.
Yes, it is.
That's awesome.
If you used it right, you could probably run the whole town with that 4 kilowatts. Well, think about it.
Yeah.
Could you run a big, strong, industrial-size motor with 4 kilowatts?
Do what?
A big, strong, industrial, 2- or 3-phase electric motor with a lot of torque and horsepower. Could you run that with 4 kilowatts? Yeah, no? Where'd you go?
Yeah, I think you can.
All right, so...
I don't know. I don't know if it's me or you, but you over here, you're breaking up.
Oh, it's probably on my side, but that's all right. Just keep talking.
Oh, it's my side. It says 4. It's my side because I've got it says 4 network connection.
Oh.
Let me hang up and talk. Let me hang up and call back.
So, Ted, you was about to answer that question. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I believe in Gerard Moran's technology of using high voltage, pulsed, high frequency to run 3-phase motors.
So if you actually had a motor system set up where you could run with your 4 kilowatts that you've got access to, a real powerful motor that could actually turn a large generator head that could actually put out more current and more voltage out the other end, and then you knew what to do with that voltage on the other side, such as storing it into a huge bank, you could get that solar panel to actually produce more energy than what you would have otherwise been able to use it as if you was using it in the conventional sense. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So you're using that power from the sun to turn this huge motor that is turning a generator head that is specifically for producing, high voltage, high frequency, and then you're running it like Gerard was doing that 2,500-watt, where now you're putting it into a 25-kilowatt transformer. You just took 4 kilowatts and ramped it up, and so now you're able to run 25 kilowatts. You see what I mean?
Yes.
Kilovolts or whatever. It's not that we don't have enough energy, it's that we're not using it efficiently. That's the whole deal. And by using unconventional methods, which basically goes against the conventional way that we're taking this energy, we're charging up batteries, we're then trying to use inverters and run these inverters, which these inverters are acting as resistance now, and then turn around and causing those batteries to have to work harder than possible. If you took your battery bank and you added a capacitor bank in between your battery bank and the inverters, then you would take that load off of your batteries and allow the capacitor bank to be a buffer between that and your inverters. That means your system is going to be more efficient. You understand what I'm saying there?
Yeah, I do.
Because it's not half enough. Batteries don't charge and discharge as fast as capacitors. They don't like to be charged and discharged fast as capacitors. And so if you're demanding too much, it takes a little more to put juice back to that battery fast enough. However, a capacitor, it's a different animal in itself. It's able to be charged faster. It's able to be discharged faster. And so if you got enough pressure to keep this energy flowing forward on demand, you can run the same exact equipment, but not put that burden on either your prime mover or your battery bank. So if you got a system that'll charge your battery bank like a gasoline engine, okay, you're going to charge that battery bank with the gasoline engine and then run your load off of the batteries instead of running it off the actual generator, that would be slightly more efficient than it would have been running it direct. Does that make sense?
Sir.
So that's what I'm talking about. You're running this energy into something else, getting it away from that generator, not allowing it to come back to that generator. And the plus would probably be to charge your capacitors and allow your capacitors to bleed over into your battery bank so that they are a buffer between the battery and the generator itself. And then on the opposite side, doing the same thing on the output side of it. Capacitors bleeding, coming off the battery, charged up to the capacitors, and you're using the capacitor bank on the opposite side as a buffer between your load and the battery. So the whole deal is in stages of keeping energy from flowing back to the battery, keeping all the energy flowing forward towards away from the generator, towards the load. Does that make sense to you? We got you back, Raymond?
Yeah.
Raymond.
Yes, sir.
Love you, bro.
Love you too, man.
So essentially, what I'm talking about is, you know, a different way. You know, right now we use solar panels to basically, the solar panels aren't running the load direct in most cases. They're charging battery banks. Those battery banks are then in turn charging inverters. And depending on the demand that you put on those inverters will determine how much draw is actually coming off of those batteries. And at certain points, if you're drawing too much, the solar panels can't keep up with it. And in the process, you're producing a lot of heat. Heat is damaging to the system. You don't want that heat. So you should be using that heat, guiding that heat somewhere else. But if you're taking that energy away from those solar panels in a completely different fashion, instead of running your load directly off of the inverters, you're just using the inverters to change the DC current into an AC wave, and then taking that AC wave and changing that to a completely different form of energy and moving it away from that inverter, that means that inverter doesn't have to work near as hard as it did.
You know, you just said something that's a little pet peeve with me, and that's the heat and solar panels. Did you realize, I mean, I know you do, that in the summertime, there's a tremendous amount of heat on the back of a solar panel. And if you were to capture that heat, in other words, mount your solar panel on a thin container and fill that container with water, well, your solar panel is mounted on an angle anyway. Right?
Yeah.
Then you've got thermo siphoning. The heat, the water in the container on the back of the solar panel would draw the heat off the solar, the backside of the solar panel, actually making the solar panel more efficient.
Yeah.
Therefore, but then again, you're heating the water, the solar panel on the angle, the thermo siphoning, the hot water would rise. So now you're getting hot water, you're getting more electricity out of your solar panel. more efficient, and you're heating hot water, which can also be used to make electricity or heat your home at night.
Yeah,
I mean,
not to mention the fact that if you run in your hot water heater, whether it be a 12-volt system or whatever, if you're running your hot water heater off of your battery bank, that's taking off the load every time it kicks on. But the way that you just described it, by taking the heat off the back of those solar panels and allow it to thermal siphon into your hot water heater, which heat rises and it'll keep that water hot, as long as it's keeping that water hot, that element will never kick on. You just made
right.
your water heater more efficient, and you made your solar panels more efficient.
Right. Exactly. That's my point. I mean, you can increase the efficiency of your solar panel by 12 to 15% simply by cooling the backside. And
yep.
cooling the backside, you're heating hot water. You're mm-hmm. heating up cold water into hot water, and you're using the hot water. I mean, daggone, man. Think about this. It's ridiculously simple.
That's why mad science is alive, because the doggone mainstream science, they should have known this kind of stuff. And the industries out there that are producing solar panels, if you're listening in, you realize how many more solar panels you could sell if you told people that they could also use it to heat their water in their house at the same exact time without using electricity from that solar panel, meaning that those solar panels would be so much more efficient and have multiple purposes for the same task?
Yep.
Think about it.
You think about it in the wintertime. You're heating hot water to heat your house.
You could actually take and develop a rubber mat that would have rubber piping inside the doggone thing, all made out of black rubber, and then either stick it to the back of your solar panel or even lay it on the roof of your house and allow the heat to actually heat that thing up, you know? But on the back of your solar panel, it would take away that rubber would absorb the heat from your solar panel and transfer that heat down into your hot water heater and so on. So it's something that could actually be done. You know? It's not rocket science. But there's a sellable product that somebody could make that would make everybody's solar panels more efficient by utilizing what would have otherwise been waste energy in an unconventional manner. Oh, man. That's why I'm a heretic, Raymond. Because I keep talking smack on the science guys out there. You know, NASA's got all these amazing claims. They've done a lot of amazing stuff. Well, I'm asking NASA, why ain't that those amazing claims being focused into resolving the so-called energy crisis of the world and resolving, energy needs to the extent where now you don't have to use near the amount of fossil fuels in order to run things, because you already made the thing so incredibly efficient that it hardly uses any fuel, and not to mention the fact that it's easing the burden on somebody's wallet, the average Joe, you know?
Let me ask you a question. How much water could you heat with 26 kilowatts of power going to heat water?
A lot.
all right. Now, the solar system I have is 4,000 kilowatts, or 4,000 watts, which is 4 kilowatts of electric power. However, the surface area is sufficient to produce 26 kilowatts of heat.
Yep.
Going into heating the water.
Well,
thing is, that sun will heat that water in the wintertime just as good as it will in the summertime.
Go watch my video, Redneck Hot Tub. I've talked about this for a long time. Now, this doggone thing, it uses a coffee pot element, a little 110 coffee pot element. So whatever a coffee pot normally draws off of your power grid, that's all it takes to heat that entire tub up to the extent where it's not insulated under the tub, it's not insulated around the tub, it's not insulated over the tub, and in the dead of winter, old crazy hair Shazooz is sitting out in the hot tub drinking a glass of wine in his swimming shorts. There is snow and ice outside, and I am sitting in this tub, and I am staying nice and toasty warm. It's the truth out of the tub. It sucks. Yeah.
I love your redneck hot tub. And, you know, I was running that test out there in my greenhouse with it. And it's not quite going to do what I needed to do for that situation. But I'm going to move it into... I live in a barn up in an old hayloft. It's got a little bit of insulation and some drywall. The floor isn't really insulated very well. It's just an old wooden floor from a hayloft. I just laid down some of that styrofoam and some carpet. It keeps it pretty warm.
Did you?
But I'm going to go up from underneath and put some of that half-inch PEX line up in there.
Yeah.
And I'm going to make that little Mr. Coffee Pot and have that little thing. And I guarantee it's not even going to need to run all that much.
Did you look into storing some of that heat energy into an old broke-down hot water tank?
Well, no, I just got a 50-gallon barrel. I was going to use it and maybe wrap it with a little bit of insulation and
right.
just use it.
Now imagine...
Just cycle it through that 50-gallon plastic drum.
Imagine if you could take that 50-gallon barrel, insulate it, and bury it under the ground so now that 50-gallon barrel acted like a thermos. So it won't take much to get that barrel hot. And that temperature holding inside there would compensate for the long runs of tubing that you had underneath your floor. You see what I'm saying? Remember you said when it was coiled up
for the greenhouse.
Yeah, for your greenhouse. But you remember when you said it when it was coiled up, it worked really well. But when you had it stretched out, it dispersed that heat too fast and wasn't able to keep up.
Yeah.
Well, that 50-gallon barrel buried under the ground, now acting as a thermos and a storage for that energy, would compensate for that longer run. It wouldn't be able to dissipate that heat as quickly. You see what I mean?
Yeah, definitely.
So if you went out and got, like, let's say, an old 15-gallon hot water heater, and you had that buried underground and really well insulated, and you had that water circulating through that element into that hot water heater, and it would use that water heater as a storage and a thermos, then all that energy going out would radiate out just like it would in that hot tub. Because if you think about what I'm saying here, that RedNet hot tub, not insulated underneath, not insulated over the top, was able to run that consistently. It took 4 hours to get it up to operating temperature, but anything past 4 hours, you had to shut that thing off because it would get too hot to physically sit inside that hot tub. It would get so hot it'd boil you. It'd kill you. Your body's supposed to 98.6 degrees. You know, maybe at 100 degrees, you're comfortable. But anything above that, at 103 degrees, your brain starts to cook. And that's not what you want to do, because it'll make you stupid.
Hey, Ted, where do you live?
West Virginia.
All right. Do you know that years ago, back in the old days, farmers that had basements in their houses would buy their fertilizer for their farm in the fall, not spring. They'd buy the fertilizer in the fall and store it in the basement, because fertilizer gives off heat. And heat would rise. Now, you live in a barn, but you live in the hay loft. So if you were to store your fertilizer or your hay or whatever that builds heat in the barn below, rather than up in the loft, you're living in the loft, you store your hay down in the bottom, that it gives off heat, that heat rises to heat your house.
Well, let me tell you what, we got this little spot down the road where all these I'll be flagging down all these trucks that cut down the trees and chip them up.
Yeah.
And I'll be having them dump them they're always looking for places to dump close to town. I have them dump over there on the side to come and dump it.
And yeah, it's a
there's
free
so
resource.
Much thermal heat over there that it's unbelievable, because I mean, you go in the middle of winter trying to get some of that good stuff out for using it or whatever, it's steaming hot in there.
Yeah.
And that was my original intention, was to use the PEX line and then go build basically a big old compost heap on top of it and cycle the water in and out of it.
Yep.
It's just
halfway.
Right,
a guy in Holland does right now, every year. He takes those wood chips you're talking about, and he has them dump them, but he puts a coil of plastic pipe in.
Right.
Under each layer, right? And then he pushes water through it. He makes enough heat to not just heat his house in the wintertime, he heats his barn.
Yeah.
No, it's no joke. It really is real. Yes. The only problem with that situation is the logistics of getting the wood chips up to where my greenhouse is positioned is difficult. And in a little, you know, S10 truck, it's going to be a lot of loads. And about, you know, a little way, about a third way into the project, I was like, you know what? I was like, you don't have to do this again next year. I was like, you might want to work on a different project. Like, this could be a heater down there where the wood chips already are, but to move them, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, but
it's a lot of work.
Right.
And you got to break it down the next year and start a fresh one.
Ted.
Which you get a lot of good compost from it. Don't get me wrong. It's just the actual logistics of that exact location be tough.
Yeah, but Ted, there are sticks and leaves and grass clippings all year long that are annoying, that if you took those grass clippings in that general area, you didn't even have to move them very far. Move them over to your compost pile. Those would do the same exact job.
I mean, y'all are right on. There's no doubt about it.
So
there's plenty of biomaterial to break down and make plenty of heat.
Where there's a will, there's a way. Not to mention the fact that whatever food wastage you might have that would have otherwise went into the trash, you throw that in the pile as well. Do the same job. Anything biological that rots will produce heat. And so your compost pile, do you even know what soil is actually is? The dirt that's actually out there?
Rotted, organic matter.
The better the soil, the finer the minerals.
Yeah, some people don't even contemplate on what dirt actually is. Dirt is trees.
Well, some people think that human beings grow food, and I don't know any human that's ever grown food. It's the soil or the water and the micronutrients that grows food.
Yeah, but it's all made up of recycled trees, leaves, grass clippings. Anything that falls on that ground basically turns into dirt. You see what I mean?
Right.
So, we're not even going to be able to run out of dirt, folks. You ain't going to run out of dirt. You're not going to run out of water. You're not going to run out of crude oil. And if you use the planet in an efficient manner, you can work in perfect harmony with nature and still be able to live in the lap of luxury, having plenty enough food. Do you know one rotted old potato will turn around, if used properly, grow a bunch more potatoes?
Yeah.
And tomatoes. When the rotted tomato, you got a whole bunch of seeds inside of every single tomato. So you got one tomato that rots on the vine, and the next year you don't ever remember. I didn't plant no tomatoes here. Look at these tomatoes growing. Why is that?
It's the same with garlic.
Yeah.
You can take one bulb of garlic and make it into 10 more bulbs of garlic.
Yep. Nature not only gave you the fruit to eat, but also gave you seeds to grow multitudes times more food. So, we shouldn't have anybody starving in this world. We shouldn't have anybody dying of thirst in this world. We shouldn't have anybody homeless.
Take, for example, you buy one tomato seed for one penny. You grow a tomato plant that grows 15 tomatoes at 200 seeds per tomato. So, now you have how many seeds? And so, the next year, you got how many plants growing, how many tomatoes, and how many seeds? I mean, before you know it, you're a millionaire.
Yep. Raymond, you just joined the crew of heretics.
There you go.
Yeah, we're sitting here telling people how to end starvation. I mean, think about it. Think about what he just said. How many apple seeds are in one apple?
Heresy, but it's like I personally view it as like, man, I don't know about y'all, but I've seen when the grocery store doesn't get a truck for 2 or 3 days. There ain't nothing in there, bud. Yep. You know what I'm saying? I don't know about y'all, but I remember that Terraco, Ratio, whatever they want to call that storm there 4 years ago. It knocked power out in West Virginia for some places 6 months.
Yep.
And before they got in there to fix some haulers. And so I don't know if about you and heresy and the fun ideas or leader. This, to me, is a very important subject that is a matter of life and death for a lot of people.
Yeah.
And, you know, as being like what I'm trying to be, like somebody that gives and, you know, an angel, try to be an angel to help people like that, it would really be hard for me to watch the power go out, then the food stop getting delivered for a couple of days, and a whole bunch of people have a really hard
imagine
time.
Imagine this,
that
Ted.
That would be really sad.
Imagine
especially
this.
Especially when I know we can stop it.
Imagine this, Ted.
Did you say you had a greenhouse, Ted?
Yeah.
Ted, did you say you have a greenhouse?
Yeah, I want to add to his greenhouse. Ted, imagine this. You can go out and buy materials that you could quite literally build a floating greenhouse. All right. Now, normally in your normal circumstance, there ain't no problem. You don't have to have a floating greenhouse because, you know, it's dry outside. But let's say hypothetically, a lot of the crops get destroyed because of flooding. Well, if you had a floating greenhouse and you had that greenhouse anchored to the good old oak tree right next to you, so it's not going to float away. If the flood comes, your greenhouse raises up off the ground and stays there, you know, floating around, and it's still doing its job. It's still growing plants. And then if the water recedes, then your greenhouse comes right back down, maybe not in the exact spot, but in the general vicinity where you can go over there and pick a tomato and eat it. So if somebody out there wanted to be an entrepreneur, you could actually go out and use existing technology to design floating greenhouses for people who are in potentially flood or tsunami prone zones. And so you could sell these floating greenhouses to people under the guise of, look, if you get flooded out, it's not going to destroy your garden. You're still going to have this food. And if it is flooded out and you can't, and the water ain't going to recede for a while, you can hook this boat up to the rope that's connected to your floating greenhouse, and you can tow it over to dry land and share your food with other people who didn't prepare like you just did. What do you think?
Yeah, kick ass. Hey, Ted, how big is your greenhouse?
Yeah, I've got 20 by 25 feet.
Okay. If you took those wood chips and put them in that greenhouse, 8-10 inches deep, right, they would rot and help keep the greenhouse warm, and to make them rot faster, you take your compost and you dig you a little hole about 6 inches diameter, about 6 inches deep, and put your compost in there, plant your plant in it. The roots from the plant will grow in that compost, but they'll also grow out into this wood chip and cause them to decompose even faster. Keep creating more heat for the greenhouse. You follow me?
Absolutely.
So where there's a will, there's a way.
The fact that the wood chips are so thick, the weeds cannot grow. And if they do, they're in wood chips, so they pull out real easy. It's called a lazy man's garden. Now, I did mine, the garden is not in a greenhouse. It's like 35 feet by 40 foot garden, and I covered it 8 inches deep in wood chips. And then I dig down through that and plant my plants in that. And I have no weeds. I do not need to cultivate. The wood chips rot. They cause the ground to stay warm in the wintertime, bringing the earthworms to the surface of the dirt itself so they can eat that rotting wood. And the earthworms, when they eat the dirt, when they poop it out, it's 8 times richer in nitrogen. You see what I'm saying?
Well, so, I'll tell you what, that's a great idea. I use hay for that kind of lazy man's garden. I learned it from that lady, Bruce Stout, on YouTube, Bruce Stout's Garden.
Right.
And that old lady, she has a way of doing it, man. You just spread that hay a couple inches thick, and you just move it over where you want to plant, and the soil is already tilled underneath all the time, 24/7.
There you go.
I don't use hay because hay contains a lot of grass seeds. Now, when grass rots, it gets up to a temperature, if you build it, your compost pile, it gets up to a temperature of about 140 degrees, and that kills the seed.
Well, it's kind of,
however, the ones on the top don't get the heat, so they grow. I don't use hay. I use winter crops such as oats or wheat or rye or barley, things that grow in the wintertime. That way, the sun, if the seeds that don't rot do sprout, they die by June the 10th, June the 15th.
Well, I tell you what, I used to use straw because it doesn't have no seed in it, or less seed in it, and, you know, weeds still are in the soil, and so I just went to hay because it's what I have for free, and I don't use it all for the animals, so I went to hay, and it's just like them wood chips. If something does grow, because it's growing in hay, and the soil is so soft under that hay, you can just pull it right out in 2 seconds. Yeah. That hay, as long as...
Oh, yeah,
you know, it works as mulch real well.
It
does have a tendency to get rotting, but if you just move the hay over, like it's 6 or 12 inches around where you want to put a plant, all that earth underneath is so beautiful because that hay has just been sitting there.
Yes, it is.
It's so nice. I love
what you're talking about. except I used wheat straw. And in the summertime, we went, I was in North Carolina, and I had a little 36 by 36 foot spot that I planted nothing but tomatoes in, and I used that method you're talking about, except I used wheat straw. And so help me, 6 weeks of 100 plus degree days, no rain, and I took my knife, cut through that packed wheat straw, and stuck my hand under it. The ground was just as cool, moist, and soft. It was unbelievable.
It's
called the lazy man's garden. It is fantastic.
All right, folks.
I grew
the only way to garden. I think it could be done on a massive scale, because if you consider your inputs, you've got all your fertilizer. I mean, you can amend with some other minerals or, you know, add a little nitrogen if you want, but all your carbon is right there. And it's like the nitrogen is there too, and I feel like, you know, it could be used for conventional style farming, and then they wouldn't have to worry about putting that ammonia in there.
Well,
you know,
with a little bit.
You mentioned nitrogen. Hey, guys. The beautiful part about it is the rotting straw or hay creates an odor that draws the earthworms up for the food of the rotting plants. And the earthworms is what creates your nitrogen in your soil. You're right.
Okay.
It's unreal. You don't need fertilizer. You don't need to cultivate. You don't need to stake your tomato plants, because tomatoes rot if they touch dirt. That's why people stake their tomato plants. But with the straw system, they don't touch the dirt, so you don't need to stake your tomato plants.
All right, folks.
Your tomatoes don't rot. They get all the nitrogen they need. It's fantastic, man. I love it.
All right, as brilliant as this conversation is, we got to start wrapping this thing up. But one of the things I want to talk about real quick was, because we're talking about gardening, even in big industrial type farming situations where they're doing hundreds of acres, if not thousands of acres of land, if you pre-planned and actually put a little investment in towards the future of possibilities of flooding or whatever, you could have that entire farm field, quite literally every single crop row, raise up off the ground with the flood level, so that whenever the water recedes, you didn't lose no crops. That's just common sense. Of course, you're talking about a different expense and re-engineering a few machines to work differently, but you could actually bury these lines slightly under the dirt and still be able to run your tractors and stuff over the top of it and not have to worry about it. And even to the extent of the, like if you use 4-inch PVC plumbing as your pontoons and had styrofoam inside there, even if the pontoon cracked, it would still remain buoyant even if it cracked, because the styrofoam would displace the water and still be able to float. So with that said, the solutions are there. Where there's a will, there's definitely a way that you could ensure that you never ran out of food. And it's all unconventional ways of thinking. It's unconventional energy. But it's things that if we took our science and our physics and we understood how nature is going to act, you can't control whether it's going to flood or not. You know, if nature wants to put some rain somewhere, it's going to happen. But why not turn that plus into a positive? You know, there are people who live right next to the Missouri River and other rivers like that, and they figured out that instead of allowing their houses to flood out every season, all they got to do is put them houses on pontoons, and when the river rises, so does the house and the garage and the car and the kids and the dog and the ducks and everything. And then when the water goes back down, you know, hey, there you go. And you got a boat tied to your front porch so that if anything goes awry, you can get out of that house and you can go down to the shoreline. That's common sense. So what we're asking for is for people to gather up dream teams in your own neighborhoods. Bring them here to Mad Science. We got tons of ideas. Do we got a few ideas, Raymond?
Yep.
What about you, Ted? We got a few ideas?
More than a few.
Well, yeah, I can go on for ideas forever. I mean, let's not forget what was going on right before World War I. Farmers were starting to use implements coated in bronze, brass. They were even using silver and gold on their implements, you know, before all the metals got collected up for the war effort. And they were literally seeing that by gardening with different metals, they were increasing and changing the bacteria and the microbes.
Yeah. Basically,
just by
also
splicing metals through the soil.
Also, because those types of metals don't corrode as fast, you know, they don't oxidize as fast as, say, iron or something. They can make them last longer. So the same tools would last longer.
Iron has a very acidic quality, and you know, silver and gold and bronze and brass have different qualities that can actually maybe keep certain bacteria under control. Think about using copper sulfate for your gardening. Well, I could talk about it forever. That's sorry to go. I know you're trying to wrap up your show, but I just love our ideas.
It's the year 2018, folks. We got no excuse why I did not to take all the knowledge that we've gathered. We're sitting here with the vast sum of all man's knowledge. And like my friend Simply Steve put up here at the top of the website, nature needs no improvement. Only the arrogance of man requires change. That's brilliant. And Stephen posted a link in there. Apparently, Russ from RWG Research is running his pulse motor competition again. And he posted a link into RWGResearch.com and events 2018. Anyway, if you want that link, jump over there to Super Chat and click on that, or just Google up Russ from RWG Research and Pulse Motors and maybe join in on the fun on that. You usually have a pretty good deal going on. But either way, what we've talked about here today is unconventional energy, and my promise to you is that I'm going to take every bit of knowledge that I got, and I'm going to start putting it in perspective to where everyone, including the average Joe, can understand what it is that I'm talking about, and show you that there is indeed a different way to use energy than the conventional method. And, you know, for the folks out there who are debunkers of free energy, stand back and watch as old crazy hair Shaziz puts up or shuts up. So, you know, I'm throwing the gauntlet down. If all you mainstream science guys out there think you got it to give, just step up to the table and let's have a conversation about real science. All right, so you might want to think I'm a heretic for what I'm saying, but, you know, the proof is in the pudding. Ain't that right, Raymond?
Yep, it is that.
That's it. We're going to get it. And we're going to help some people out, and just by taking and using all the knowledge we got, there is a better way to do a whole lot of stuff. Maybe at first it might not be the most financially inexpensive way to do it. There's other ways to do everything, but we could build houses that would withstand, you know, the ravages of nature and you know, the ignorance of man, so to speak. And we could build, you know, things that would work in harmony with nature. You know, it's storming outside. You're in a flood-prone zone. You know there is a potential flood, and it's 50-50 chance of whether or not nature's going to put too much water where you're at. Then why not use a little bit of physics to make your house float and use a little bit of physics to keep your house in place whenever your house does float, and then you can sit there and live happily ever after without ever having to worry about the disaster. You know, the insurance companies, they make a lot of money off of natural disasters. And they got this clause, they call it the act of God clause. If a tree falls on your house, that's probably considered an act of God. Well, can't do nothing about it. That's an act of God. Yeah, right. We can resolve this issue. Anyway, folks, you've been listening to the Mad Science Show. Hope you like what we've been talking about. If you do like what we've been talking about, please pass the information and links on to other people so they can enjoy the information as well. And we hope to bring you a whole bunch of more good content. So, Ted, you got anything last you want to say before we're out here?
Just thank you. Thank you, Shaziz. Appreciate you.
Cool. Appreciate you guys as well. What about you, Raymond?
Oh, I'm doing fine, man. I want to talk to Ted more.
Well, he's going to talk to Ted when we go off the air. But in the meantime, folks, I'm going to play us out of here with the Bug's Life, a little deal there. Listen to what that grasshopper's telling them, the other grasshoppers, about the bugs. You could probably learn something from that. But I say I got my dream team all geared up and we're already running, and so I want you to build your dream team and put them in your neighborhood to resolve all the issues and find solutions. And if you guys run across something on your dream team that you can't resolve, just call up one of the other dream teams out there available at your disposal, either on Shaziz Radio or People for People Radio Network, or even over there to Wolf Spirit Radio or any other affiliated networks listening in and repodcasting. That's a lot to say real quick. But anyway, And we will share our research with you. You share your research with us. We'll get it done like we should have got it done a long time ago. It's 2018, not, what's that, old Stone Age. Do you realize how long it took them from the time that science says that they were running around with sharp objects butt naked in the jungle before they ever figured out that they could stay warm with fire and clothes? Didn't make much sense to me, but hey, yeah, there's a podcast about that in there. So anyway, peace and love, everybody. You've been listening to Mad Science. Stay tuned. Take care.
Was that ant that stood up to me?
Yeah, but we can forget about him.
Yeah, it was just one ant.
Ooh.
One ant.
Yeah, you're right. It's just one ant.
Yeah, boss. They're puny.
Puny? Say, let's pretend this brain is a puny little ant.
Did that hurt?
Nope.
Well, how about this one?
Are you kidding?
Well, how about this?
You let one ant stand up to us, then they all might stand up.
Those puny little ants outnumber us 100 to 1. And if they ever figure that out, there goes our way of life.
It's not about food. It's about keeping those ants in line. That's why we're going back.
Does anybody else want to stay?
Space, the final frontier. These are the voyages of the Starship Enterprise. Its continuing mission: to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations, to boldly go where no man has gone before.
Crap.
Operator, give me the number for 911.
God's name is going on in here. What was that ruckus?
What ruckus?
I was just in my office and I heard a ruckus.
Could you describe the ruckus, sir?
Watch your tongue, young man. Watch.